So you'll describe the bills?
I will.
Okay, are we ready? The House Interim Committee on Revenue will come to order. Colleagues, our first order of business is a work session, which we will now open on bill introduction. Paul, do you want to describe what we're doing this morning?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, everyone. As you recall, the House rules limit you to three committee bill introductions, and these are the three on OLIS. The first is LC 195. That is your traditional reconnect to the federal IRS code. There have been some changes. We had intended to go through some of that with you today, most all of which are picked up on our rolling reconnect, but we're not quite ready for that, so we're going to move that back to a later agenda time. But this bill itself is largely technical because it connects to the definitional changes that are not associated with the rolling reconnect. So that's the LC 195, and that's a bill you get every year. The next one is LC 273. It directs us, Legislative Revenue Office, to prepare a report on tax expenditures, but it's largely a placeholder bill relating to tax expenditures. If you have need for that, it gives you broad latitude. LC 196 is a bill that is designed to come into play if an initiative, which I believe is Initiative 71, gets approved by voters. That's the privatization of liquor. This would establish a tax system that would mimic our current revenue system. So it would be a contingency bill contingent on the passage of the initiative.
Right. Not intended to raise any money. You'll note, colleagues, that the relating clauses for the second two bills allow us a little flexibility if we need it. I've been telling the Speaker every short session that the Revenue Committee is going to need additional bills. I just don't know what they are, because Congress will do something to us, or somebody else will. It requires us to act in a short session. This session, I might be wrong because of the relating clauses that we have. So, Representative Vance?
What's the right phrase? I move
that the committee introduce.
I move the committee introduce the three proposed bills.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves that the committee introduces the three proposed bills, LC 195, LC 273, and LC 196. Any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's adopted. We'll close the work session on bill introduction. And we're going to change the agenda some, and Paul's taken the one with the notes on it, so I'm going to have to look. Oh, what we're doing is it turns out that we're not ready on the implication of federal tax policy changes. We're going to try to hold a hearing on that very early in session. Hopefully we'll have a report from the Oregon CPAs at that time, so we know what we're working on. We are going to move. We're going to switch then the item called pricing transferable energy tax credits from 10:10 to now, and hear from Chris about that. And then we'll go on with the agenda in the order that it's been printed. Chris, do you want to bring us up to date on pricing transferable energy tax credits?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So the transferable energy tax credits, there are some issues that you've heard about in the past about the pricing of those.
Well, for the record?
For the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. And so what I was going to do here is just kind of take a step back and provide some context for the transferable tax credits and present some information on the Betsy and tax credits from 2007 through 2014. And the context for the issue relating to the pricing, there's kind of a short-term issue about what the legislature may or may not do in February, and then a potentially longer-term issue with what the legislature may do in 2017, because the energy tax credits are scheduled to sunset in 2018, so they're part of the regular tax credit review. And all of this information, it's historical and contextual for the tax credit, for the business energy tax credits, and the transferability and the pricing of those tax credits, but it's all geared toward potential action that the legislature may or may not consider in February. So the first table here is the history of the business energy tax credits. And again, maybe I should start out with a very high-level discussion of how the process for the energy tax credits has worked. If I'm an individual and I want to undertake some sort of energy-related project, a qualified project, I won't get into exactly what that means, but it can deal with renewable energy or conservation, I go to the Department of Energy and say, I have this project that I want to do. It's building something, installing something, constructing something. And I sit down with the Department of Energy. I go through their application process. And if my project meets all of their criteria, I can get a pre-certification for a tax credit of some amount. And the tax credit can be a one-year tax credit or a five-year tax credit, depending on the size of the tax credit. But at a very high level, I engage in a conversation with the Department of Energy. I apply, and they basically say, okay, if I do everything I said I'm going to do and I meet all these criteria and I fulfill the project, I will get the tax credit. At that point, I'm given a pre-certification. So I take that pre-certification, I go back, and I do my project. And that can take a couple months or a couple of years. But once my project is complete, I go back to the Department of Energy and say, I finished the project, and they sit down and they go through their process, their administrative process, and confirm that I did, in fact, do the project properly, I met all the requirements. At that point, they give me a final certification, at which point I can now start claiming that tax credit. And if it's a one-year tax credit, I claim it in that tax year. If it's a five-year tax credit, the first of those 5 years occurs in the year that I receive final certification. So the course structure is that in which I am the one who earns the credit, I'm awarded the credit, and then I use the credit. Statute also envisions the possibility of me selling that tax credit. It could be because I'm a business and I expect to have no liability. I'm a startup or whatever, but I won't be able to use the tax credit, so I could sell it. Or it could be that I'm a nonprofit or a governmental entity, which I know I will not have any tax liability because I'm not subject to tax. And right now, statute envisions at the beginning of that process, I go in, and at the pre-certification stage, I go in and say, I'm a nonprofit. I'm not going to be able to use the tax credit, but I can qualify and earn the tax credit because I'm going to do the appropriate project. At the time of pre-certification, there's a sales price determined on the tax credit. So if it's a $1 million tax credit, I can sell it for 70%, 80%, 90%, whatever that amount is. And that's kind of the core issue, is the pricing of that transferable tax credit. So with that in mind, from 2007 to 2014, there were 12,600 tax credits that were awarded. They involved about just under $2.1 billion in certified costs, kind of the basis for the tax credit. $907 million in tax credits were earned on those projects. This percentage column right here is simply the credit divided by the certified cost, and in aggregate, I'm losing my eyesight, 43%. And the tax credits are either 35%, and those are for conservation projects, or 50% for other. It's either 35% or 50%. I don't want to get in too much of the detail there. So this mean percentage is a weighted percentage. And I chose 2007 through 2014. 2007 is when the program had a significant expansion. The program actually began in 1979, but 2007 there was a big expansion. And then 2014 is when the program was finally sunset. So of those $907 million in tax credits that were earned or awarded to the people who did the project, so to speak, $660 million of that was transferred. They were sold. They were subject to the transfer part of the program. So that's about 73% of the program went through this transfer process in aggregate. Yeah, that percentage ranged from a low of 58% in 2011 to up to 100% in 2014. Towards the end of the project, the last couple of years, almost all of the projects were transferred.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, so, and we know that because the Department of Energy tracks that as well, how many were sold, or how do we know specifically how many of them were sold?
Yes, all of this information comes from data that the Department of Energy sent me.
And so they track it all the way through. Okay.
And there, as this, I've worked with the Department of Energy for a number of years, and they've been very helpful in sharing the information. And the information that they track and their databases have modified over time as the project has grown. So all of this information is as of a certain date because they give me information, but it all comes from an active database.
Great.
That changes, you know, on a daily basis, so to speak.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chris, do we know what percentage of these credits that have been awarded went to actual entities that had tax liability versus nonprofits or governmental entities? What the division is of the total there?
I'm going to get to that. It's about $243 million went to people who kept and used the tax credit. They awarded it and they used it. And then they're in the process of claiming it.
I think you asked a slightly different question.
The question is how many actually were businesses, private sector entities versus nonprofits or government? That's the question.
Oh.
Folks that actually had real life tax liability.
I don't have that here. Okay. I have a little piece of that related to kind of what's in the queue right now, but historically don't have that information, and I'd have to confirm if it's available because there would need to be, if there's a field that identifies that, it's easy enough, but if it's just who claims it, it would be a matter of going through that and recognizing that school district or business, so it may or may not be readily available. I can get a check on that.
Thank you.
That would certainly be handy if it's readily obtainable.
Right.
So we understand what the shape of the data is.
Exactly.
Representative Woodson.
So could you describe when a tax credit is allocated to the year used, a one-year tax credit? Could you describe the situation? Is the project completed in that year, or how does that work? And do you have any knowledge of backdating tax credits?
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsett, I have no knowledge of any backdating of tax credits, but the way the legislature envisioned the process to work, and as I understand it, I get my pre-certification, I go back and I finish my project, and I complete it in, say, year 2010. If that happens, so once it's completed, I'll go to the Department of Energy, say it's completed. They'll go through some verification process, and then once they're satisfied that I did in fact complete the project and I met all of the requirements, they would grant me, it's a piece of paper, my final certification. So they're, for the most part, those two will be the same year. But if I complete my project on, say, December 20th, and I might not get my final certification until January 15th, and if I have a calendar year tax year, there can be a difference between those 2 years. But by and large, it should be in that same year.
But it's always after you've demonstrated that the project is in operation.
The final certification is not to be granted until Energy is satisfied that I completed the project.
So then the credit goes back to that year. It's not for the year that they certified that it was completed, if it's in that time frame. So the credit goes back to the year that you've determined that it was completed, not allowable for the year, the next year.
The tax credit would be for the year in which I'm granted the final certification. So if I complete my project on June 30th, mm-hmm. I have a calendar year tax year. I complete my project on June 30th, and I get my final certification on August 1st, then I can claim the tax credit in that year. Is that, I'm not sure if I'm tracking the question.
I'm looking for those that are finished, say, in October, November, December. They don't get certified until the next year. Then do you give the credit for the year that they were completed, even though the certification isn't completed until the
My understanding would be the final certification, the year of final certification.
So that would be the next year then.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And again, there, without straying too far, but there were some other tax credits that the larger projects they were subject to, they became referred to as a six-year Betsy, where there was kind of a delay there. And I'm trying not to go on too many rabbit trails, so I'm trying to stick to kind of the core structure of the program.
Yeah, with the most of the people on the committee now were not involved in establishing the structure that we're talking about. So I think hitting the basic structure so that the newer members of the committee come to understand it, as some of us who have lived through it do, I think is the key. And then if we get it down to rabbit trails, it'll be because members asked for it, and that'll be our fault.
Okay. Okay, of those six, so just to recap, $907 million, in this time period, $907 million in projects were completed and awarded final certification. $660 million of those were sold. They were transferred to somebody. And that transaction right there, that $660 million in tax credits, were collectively sold for $462 million. So at an annual aggregate level, for this time period, that's basically 70 cents on the dollar that the tax credits were sold for. And that ranged between 68% and 74% on an annual basis here. Now, these are aggregated figures. I'm going to get in a little bit. I'll get to another slide that has a little more refined information on these transfer prices. But just context, big picture, $907 million in tax credits awarded. 243 of million were kept and used by the people who earned them or the taxpayers who earned them. 660 million were sold for $462 million.
Wow.
So okay. More context. So the bottom line is the transfer piece of the program has been a significant part of the program for some time. So in terms of how many kept or sold of the 12,619 tax credits, about 60% of them were kept and used, and 40% were actually transferred. So most of the tax credits were kept and used by the entities who earned them. Dollar-wise, though, it's kind of flipped. About 75% of the tax credit dollars were sold, and 25% were kept and used.
So that suggests that the large ones were more likely to be sold.
Correct. And so we had, of the 12,619 tax credits, 7,383 and 243 million were kept and used by those who earned the tax credits. So the 5,236 tax credits, or the 660 million, were sold to a total of 6,522 taxpayers. So you get more taxpayers involved because one tax credit could be sold to two different people. Or it can be sold. Some of them were sold for up to 10 people. You might have $1 million tax credit, and it gets sold to 10 people for $100,000. And it could also be that I earned $1 million tax credit, and I kept and used 200,000 of that and sold 800,000 of it. So the 12,619 tax credits certified translate into just under 14,000 taxpayers claiming tax credits on their returns. So the transferred tax credits, in looking at Department of Energy does track the transfer rate or the sales price or the pass-through rate. And so this information is based on that. And there were some key price points in here. It wasn't a very smooth or continuous price break. So I've grouped them together here. So for all tax credits, for those sold at under 70%, most of them were sold at 67%. And there were 665 of these tax credits. Their total was $386 million, and then they were sold for $259 million. Within the 70s, for a pass-through rate, 70% to 79%, most were sold at 73%. And so forth and down the line. And between 80 and 89%, most were sold at 87%. And the 70 to 90% is where the bulk of the tax credits were sold, right here, as you can see by the number of tax credits. The dollar amounts were basically sold for less than 80%. And some were sold for more than 90%, and most of those were sold at 97%. But those tended to be the small one-year tax credits. So I've taken this combined table.
Representative, what's it?
I was wondering if you could describe, or if you've broken out who the average taxpayer was that were purchasing these credits. Were they corporations? Were they individuals? Have you broken them down, and what tax bracket were they in?
Chair Barnhart, Rep. Witsit, I do have that information. I didn't include it in here, so I can certainly get that to committee. And there is a strong breakout between corporations and individuals. Most of the dollars are on the corporate side, and most of the taxpayers might be on the personal side. I do have that information. I don't have it with me here, but I can get that to you.
Thank you.
Are you planning to talk about how it is that we got to these different numbers of the amount of the sale price for the transferred tax credits? And that changed over time, didn't it?
Yes, I'm going to talk.
You'll get there. Okay.
But partially. I'll have a partial answer to that.
I'm just slightly.
Yes.
Sorry, I'm catching
Thank
up
you.
Here. I'm just slightly math challenged. When you say it's sold at 70% or 90%, what is it you're saying to me in English?
Eight.
Does that mean if the tax credit's worth $100,000, it was sold at 70? Is that what I'm supposed to translate that into? Or
yeah, I'll stick.
And then the money made is on the 30. Is that how that works?
So if I sell you a $100 tax credit for $90, that's 90% or 90 cents. And I apologize. I do kind of switch my terminology. I try to be consistent.
But right.
It's 90 cents on the dollar or 90%.
Okay.
So when I say 73%, a $100 tax credit was sold for $73.
Okay. So the lower that number goes, the better it is for the seller, right? Like if I sell it, the other way around, the higher it is, the better.
The purchaser does better with the lower number. The seller does worse because they get fewer dollars.
Okay.
Yeah. Are you finished, Representative Noss?
I think so.
Yeah, Representative Leininger.
We'll see.
Well, for now.
Yeah.
Representative Leininger.
I got to take a
have a question to understand the situation also. Is the scenario in which these credits were awarded that someone said they were going to do a project that was going to have an energy efficiency impact or something, and so they would get an allocation from the state of maybe like $1 million in tax credits to support putting solar panels on the roof of a school or a nonprofit or something? And then is it the case that the expectation at the time the award was made was that they would resell the tax credits to generate the revenue to do the project? Mm-hmm. I mean, that was everybody's understanding going in, right? That if I'm a nonprofit or some entity that had a worthwhile project that the state at that time deemed worthwhile and I applied for and got a $1 million allocation, didn't everyone understand that the point was that if I was a nonprofit or if I was a business that maybe didn't end up with $1 million in tax credit liability, that it was okay for me to sell it and then the market would yield the market price? I mean, it might not have been good policy, but it feels like we're questioning whether that's a surprising outcome, but my impression from a distance was that that's what people understood the rules of the game to
be.
Right. I think, Chair Barnhart, Rep. Leininger, I think that's certainly the case. If we go back to 2008 and a school district installs solar panels and they go through the project, they go through the financing, they go through everything they need to do to say it's a viable project and they can undertake it, and they talk to the Department of Energy, they go through that process, and Energy says, well, if you do the project, you will be eligible, you will earn a $1 million tax credit. And the school district, presumably, understands that, okay, well, the tax credit doesn't do them any good, but transferability had been in law for 10 years at this point, so this was part of the program. And the school district would say, okay, well, I earn $1 million tax credit, I can turn around and sell it for some amount. Now, in 2008, having been here and lived through this, but and I can't speak for everybody, I don't know how clear it was exactly what that pricing mechanism was. And in another slide or two, I'm going to get to some legislation that passed in 2009. Because in 2009, this transfer piece started to become an issue in terms of people wanting to understand exactly how does that work. Is it purely a market price where the school district has their $1 million tax credit, and they can go out and they talk to their CPA, and they can sell it to whoever at any price? There was very broad language. And now, having said that, in statute, there was very broad language around the transferability. It was allowed, but it wasn't necessarily very precise in terms of restrictions on that transaction.
One follow-up?
Yeah. Please go ahead.
Thanks.
Yeah.
So is the sort of uproar that has been written about recently that people are upset to recognize that the resale value of the tax credits was as low as it was and that there wasn't a floor price put in by the state? Or what is the new thing that happened that has caused people to be so concerned?
Is that something you're going to get to later?
In part, that's kind of I'm trying to set the backdrop for the expectation here was I don't know how well understood this mechanism was back in 2008. In 2009, there was legislation designed to put sideboards on the transactions. And it's difficult to exactly understand or comment on why people are upset about it. But from what I understand, some people don't like this low price, the 73% or the 67%. There might be a lack of understanding on present value calculations, because some of these tax credits, most of them, especially the large dollar ones, actually all except the smallest, are five-year tax credits. Mm-hmm. That if I earn $1 million tax credit over 5 years, I get to claim it's like $350,000 in the first year, $350,000 in the second year, and then $100,000 in the final 3 years. So there's a present value calculation of money, which I'm not sure is.
Are you going to talk about that today?
I do have a slide that shows the formulas but, where I mean, talk about that.
I think it's really important, and thank you, Representative Leininger, for the question. I think it's really important that the committee and the public understand how present value is calculated by people wearing the green eye shades and the people who actually buy and sell securities of a variety of sorts. Because we're competing in these credits compete in the market for other kinds of ways of investors making money. And so it's important to understand how these pieces fit together. If it's okay with the committee, what I'd like to do is allow Chris to go ahead and go through his presentation. If you have a question on a specific point that he's making, please raise it. And let's hold the others to the end so that he can actually get through this. Because I think some of the questions that you're asking may be answered later on in the presentation. Is that okay, Representative Bantz?
Yeah, it is certainly okay, Mr. Chair. I just want to, so that we can anticipate what you're going to show us, to build on Representative Leininger's thought. You're going to, because the question both are talking about here is how badly did the state do in the investment of these monies? And the measure of that might be that space between what Chair Barnhart just called out, the market, and what actually happened. So you may be getting to that. That would be the measure of how outraged we should be or not.
Or not, right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, so this was all the transferable tax credits. And I broke them down to separate the 1 year and the 5 year. And the story here is that the 1 year tax credits were sold at tended to be sold at either 87% or 97%. Those were the 1 year. Those were people buy it and they can pretty much use it in that year. And these were all small dollar tax credits. To be a 1 year tax credit, the cost of the project had to be less than $20,000. So these are the small ones. The vast majority of the dollars were in the five-year tax credits, and you can see that most of these were sold at either 67 or 73%, although some of them were sold in the 80s or even 90s.
And is there a temporal relationship to those numbers? Did it tend to be one kind of number at one time period and a different number at another time period?
No, there didn't. I tried to look at that, and I went through this to try and display the information in a bunch of different ways, and there pretty much were four price points, 67%, 73%, 82%, and 97%. And I didn't notice any relationship to them changing over time.
Time.
Okay. At least within this project, 07 to 14, it was the height of the Betsy program, and I think all of that process was undergoing, and the changes that were put in place in 2009 really affected tax credits going 2012 and forward, which is part of the issue that's before the committee. So moving forward into 2009, as people were getting concerned about this, because there were stories of somebody selling, earning a $1 million tax credit and selling it for, say, $700,000. And part of the concern there, and I guess this is just kind of circling back to the point just made, is that the perspective is that the state lost out on $300,000 because whatever entity undertook that project and accepted $700,000 from their piece of the tax credit, the argument goes is that the state, rather than issuing $1 million in tax credits, could have just provided that entity $700,000. So I think, and not that I can speak for the people who are upset about this, but I think that's kind of the core issue, is that the state could have done better had they just provided the $700,000 to this hypothetical project, rather than issuing $1 million tax credits and having this cottage industry for transferable tax credits take place. I think, well, I'll just leave it at that. I think that's one aspect for the people who are upset about it. So in 2068, this was a bill that was passed and signed into law, and I just took it from the bill, so the italicized language is what was removed and the bold language is new. So may was converted to shall, so it was permissive language before this, and it became shall for the Department of Energy to create a formula. And there was a lot of discussion in 2009 about what that formula should be. People were upset about the pricing they were hearing about the state losing out, so to speak.
Good point.
And there were a lot of discussions back and forth about how precise this formula should be. And so this language represents a kind of compromise where the legislature doesn't go in and specify exactly what the formula is, because there's a recognition that it would be a dynamic situation in terms of the appropriate pricing. And the key things in here are for the Department of Energy to incorporate were some measure of inflation and real market rate of return. And in another slide or two, I'm going to have the formulas that have been in place and are currently used. And then the department was to update this formula quarterly. And this is what they have done since 2012, or 2009, by the time it got in place. They've been doing it since then for, I think, what they've called the pass-through program.
Yeah, Representative Betts.
So I want to go back to your assertion that the concern was why don't we just hand them the $700,000 and call it good and avoid that $300,000 haircut? And the can you explain to us that $700,000 in many cases was to be spread over 5 years? So there's a cost of funds issue there. So we would have given them what, a fifth of $700,000, then the next year a fifth of $700,000, next year a fifth of $700,000, and so forth. In the normal course, there would be a cost of funds. Because we have to allocate those funds in advance, saying we're going to take that out of the budget 2 years from now, 3 years from now, 4 years from now, and make that payment. And so there's a cost there of some sort. I don't know if it adds up to $300,000,
right.
but are you going to address that issue also?
Well, partially, I guess, here in the formulas, and that really gets at, I think part of what you're getting is the present value of money. So if I've earned $1 million tax credit, I understand that I can't, even if I'm a business and I can claim it, that's over 5 years. And part of the risk there is whether or not I'm going to have liability for 5 years. And that's one aspect into the formulas in terms of calculating the risk. But even then, just ignoring the risk, the $1 million that I have today is discounted over time. And arguably, $1 million today, or $1 million over 5 years, is worth $900,000 today, $800,000 today, or $700,000 today.
Right. Okay.
There'll be that aspect, and there are broad form. And what the formulas try to get at is at a, I guess, statewide level, what that value is. Now, part of the argument here is that the market is better at determining that, because broadly speaking, you can come up with a formula that says $1 million over 5 years is worth $800,000 today. You can create a formula to come up with that arithmetic. You throw in tax liability, that whatever that present value is for my personal situation may be different from yours. And it may be worth $900,000 to me, or it may be worth $700,000 to you.
Yeah.
And that's largely the argument for allowing the market to price these at whatever the market does, and versus having a formula. But it's a give and take in terms of the perspective of the state losing out on this hypothetical $300,000. But I think one of the things that I've found consistent here is an understanding, or an intuitive understanding, of the present value of money, and recognizing that $1 million right now wasn't going to be claimed on the tax returns anyway. It was over 5 years. And so part of the state, so even when we say $1 million tax credit, these are all in nominal dollars. To get at the core value, I would need to convert all of these to constant dollars at some amount. So $1 million tax credit, if I want to talk about $1 million and say we're back in 2009, $1 million tax credit, I would want to put that in present value. That would probably be a better way to understand the sales price. So I can go back to, if we're in 2009, the state awards $1 million tax credit, and I discount it simply for inflation, maybe, but even real rate of return, if we're talking about investments, then $1 million tax credit is really only $900,000 or something less than that. It's a really tough calculation conceptually, because it really is the market. And the other aspect that factors into all of this is the risk of a taxpayer having the tax liability for 5 years. So whatever the formula is, it would need to incorporate that risk of not having a tax liability. Now, the tax credits do have an 8-year carry forward. So it's not that the taxpayers will necessarily lose the tax credits, but if you talk to a taxpayer about claiming a tax credit today versus 10 years from now, those are very different. And you can get to low value dollars here. And as I walk through the 5-year tax credit, we can see how a 1-year tax credit might be worth 95 cents on the dollar, but a 5-year tax credit is already only worth 80 cents on the dollar with a very similar formula. And I hope I didn't.
And that's based entirely on the current estimates for all those risk factors you were talking about, the inflation rate, the simple time value of money even without inflation, and then that risk that a quaint economics way of putting it, the possibility that the purchaser may not have that much tax liability.
Correct.
Yeah.
It's, and I don't know if this is a good analogy or not, it's almost the inverse of the value of compound interest. I mean, that can have a big effect, and this is present value.
Well, it is compound interest, but it's drawn as a discount instead of added on.
Right.
Yeah. Representative Benz, please.
So are you going to, it seems as though, if to go back to the suggestion that we could have written a check out from the state every year for under our hypothetical 5 years, a fifth of 700,000. If we had done it that way, would many of the elements that you just talked about that are specific to the taxpayer, would they go away then, and would that increase the value of the credit? Because that the state doesn't have to suffer from those. I'm not sure what the state suffers from when it tries to look forward 7 years or 5 years and determine the cost of this commitment. I don't know what that formula would show us. But is there a difference between those two? Obviously there is, but what's the pricing consequence of that difference?
The first problem that I think of there is kind of guaranteeing budget dollars over different biennia. That's a different.
Well, that's a legal
that's
problem.
That's a different kind of obstacle, but it's real nonetheless.
Let me add a factor to what Representative Bent said, because I think he left one out, and that is the need then for the entity that actually did the project to finance the money that they would get up front from a purchaser,
right,
versus what they would get from the state being paid over the 5 years. That the difference between those two numbers at the beginning at least has to be financed somehow or another, either by foregoing income in another account or by borrowing money in order to cover it. So add that to the piece that Representative Benz asked, and then answer that question.
Well, and that's a real risk to the calculation, because if I'm an entity and I can earn $1 million tax credit and sell it for $700,000, and so my finances work out that I need $700,000, I can go that route, or I can borrow the $700,000 and pay that interest rate, or versus earning the tax credit. So it can get very complicated in terms of the market pricing.
Well, this is called to see if we can stump Dr. Allen. Mr. Representative Benz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the one of the factors I haven't heard you mention yet is the possibility, not that this ever happens, the legislature would change the rules on these tax credits as they wait, the taxpayers who have purchased these, whatever they are, looking forward. How is that factored in? Because this brings back a series of discussions over the past 8 years where you've repeatedly reminded us of these realities. Does that ever factored in, or do we just say that's a risk you take by buying one of these devices?
Every individual entity in the market is going to factor that in, their likelihood of the legislature changing the rules on the tax credits. I can say that a lot of options were considered, and legislative council was consulted about what can the legislature do with the tax credits. Even if they've been pre-certified, can the legislature come in and cancel the tax credits? And Paul may remember more detail, but basically the legislature can, but the legislature was very reluctant, if not loath, to do that for the potential ramifications down the road. Because once the legislature says, oh, creates these tax credits and they're out there, and a few years down the road, the legislature comes back and says, yeah, never mind, then future policy, there are significant implications for future policy down the road. So while legally that was a tool at the legislature's disposal, at least from where I sit, the legislature, it was never a real possibility for the legislature to do that because of those ramifications.
Yeah, who would ever believe us again?
Basically.
Please go ahead. This is the interesting piece. Representative Nose, this is the meat of the whole project.
Great, because I don't understand that at all. But okay.
So,
I looked ahead.
These are the formulas, and I apologize for the algebra. These are the formulas that are that the Department of Energy came up with as a result of House Bill 2008 from 2068 from 2009. So for the one-year tax credit, the present value is simply the value of the tax credit. So in the example here, it's a $100 tax credit. And the factors that they consider in terms of, again, the statute referred to inflation projections and market real rate of return. So what energy landed on incorporating were the two-year treasury yield. These are published every day or every other day. And then a change in the three-year CPI for the Urban West Consumer Price Index, both numbers that are publicly available on a regular basis.
So I have a question.
And
excuse me.
Okay, so do I understand this correctly, that over a five-year time period, they decided that there was a 16% decline in the dollar? If you look at that, at 1 year, 99, say, equals 100, and 5 year, it's 83, that $1 equals, or 100 equals 83, you're looking at a 16% decline, is that correct?
Well, let him go through the formula because I think that may clarify the question you're asking.
Okay.
So these were the factors that they considered. So I'm selling a hundred to determine the price of a $100 tax credit. It's the $100 face value, and it's two times the two-year treasury yield. Now, at the time, or currently, they've just updated this for the current quarter. And these numbers are each as of a specific date. So I think because at some point they have to determine what the formula is. So on a given date, the two-year treasury yield was 0.82%.
So it was 2.8%, okay.
0.82%.
All right.
And the three-year change in the
CPI
was 1.072%.
How did they calculate that number?
The CPI?
Yes, the 1 point. I mean, is it additive, or how do they do it?
This CPI, it's a monthly figure. So in December, they looked back to November of, so it is November, the November CPI, November 2015 CPI, divided by 2 years prior to that.
Okay.
basically the change in CPI between November 2013 to November 2015. And there's some more arithmetic that I can
Right, and the arithmetic does the adjustment for changing it from a one-year number to a three-year
number.
Okay.
Right.
Okay, and that's why you got 7% instead of 2+.
I could do this.
Because it's 3 years versus 1 year.
Yeah, it's kind of an average three-year, the average CPI change over 3 years.
And that percent sign, is that real?
Yes, it's so 1%.
1.1%.
It's 1%, not 7%.
It's 1.1%, okay.
1.1%.
So this, the 0.28% is a very tiny number.
Yes.
Divide that whole thing by 100 and leave the percent sign off and you get it.
Right, so 0.82% is equivalent to 0.0082.
All right.
And 1.072% is equivalent to 0.01072.
All right.
Okay.
And so the two fact, as I understand their thinking and trying to...
Representative Davis?
Thank you, Chair. Thanks, Chris. And so the theoretical underpinning is that the risk-free factor of a two-year investment is 0.82%.
Correct. It's a pretty safe investment, so the return.
Right. What the market would call a risk-free investment,
yes.
Investment in a treasury.
Right.
And then the three-year change in inflation from the factor of consumers purchasing items in the market is essentially 1%.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. So the first number is the time value of money, assuming everything is flat. And the second number is adding in inflation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Okay.
You have the inflation. The first one is kind of the potential earnings of an investment, and the second is...
I'm sorry.
So
I had it backwards,
kind of,
didn't
yeah.
I? Yeah.
And the second is the inflation, so the real value of money.
Great. I don't think it's possible to talk about this
person made a dollar.
In too many different ways because it's very complicated. The more different ways we talk about it, the more likely it is that the committee members and the members of the public will understand what these formulas mean.
Right.
If you work with money every day, you know what these mean.
Yeah.
But most of the rest of us don't.
But at a high level, it's what can I earn on the investment in constant dollars? I also want to adjust for that. And so we're talking about one-year tax credits here.
Not very much.
So it's not very much. And interest rates right now are pretty low. So
now, if we were during the Carter administration and we were dealing with an inflation rate of 17%, making up numbers here, this formula would still apply, but the number you ended up with would be a lot smaller, wouldn't it?
Right. That the $83 here for the five-year might be a one-year.
Right.
If
simply because of inflation.
If you're in an inflationary period.
And, of course,
yes.
the Treasury discount would be the 1 year or 2 year Treasury yield would be much higher as well,
right.
Just to account for inflation.
Mm-hmm. Right. But that's the big picture, and that was put in statute, the broad sideboards, about what the formula, because there was definite interest on having some sort of sideboards, a formula related to these transactions.
So whatever behavior we were trying to send.
The return here is not very large.
Well.
And just to, I'm going to bounce back and forth here. This blue line is what this 1 year price of the tax credits has been since 2012. It's generally been 97%, 98%, 99%.
So we're out of dollar. Maybe that was okay.
So now we're the 5 year tax credit. So the time horizon is 5 years. So you expect the present value to be much lower. And so the formula here is conceptually the same, but there's some technical differences. Again, the two components relating to rate of return and inflation, instead of a two-year treasury yield, it's a five-year treasury yield. So again, moving to the five-year because that's the time period for the tax credit, so Energy wanted to tie to that, so that makes sense. And they stuck with a three-year change in the CPI, kind of the midpoint of the 5 years. And so the $100 example here is divided by 1 plus 3 times the 5-year treasury yield minus the CPI change. Now, one thing I wanted to point here, to my understanding, the factor 2 here and the factor 3 here was a way to try and get at the risk for the taxpayers having the liability over the time period. So they wanted to factor that in somehow, and that's how they've done that.
But they pulled that out of the air, in effect, because they don't actually know.
Yes. I mean, nobody's going to
know. It's an estimate.
Nobody's going to know. And the whole exercise, and there will be the whole exercise of coming up with a formula that is in place for a quarter can be argued to be somewhat arbitrary, because a lot can happen over 3 months that could change these. But the way the structure is, that this is the formula for 3 months. Every 3 months it can change. Mm-hmm. And again, that's where the legislature landed in 2009. Do you want a formula that changes every day, every year, every month? And it landed on the quarter, again, kind of a compromise aspect.
So if I had earned a tax credit, a five-year tax credit, and I wanted to sell it, if the value of that tax credit was based on the day that I received it, and I called my broker and I said, let's sell this thing, then whatever this formula produced is approximately what I ought to get for it.
Right.
Assuming an efficient market.
Right.
Assuming an efficient market, assuming that the formulas reflect that efficient market.
Reasonably
that,
reflects.
That's kind of tied
reasonably,
up in
right. Reasonably yeah. reflects the market. And okay.
Now, one of the pieces that we're going to, you know, in a bit of foreshadowing, again, tying back to the overall core structure of the tax credit, the prices here, I would use if I own the tax credit, it would be the price set at the time of pre-certification. So that's kind of the front door, if you will, the stage one of the process. Now, the time it takes me to complete my project can be within the quarter. In that case, it's fine, but it can be a couple of years. And so now it'll be a couple of years, and I won't get any interest in somebody buying my tax credit until I'm either nearly done or completely done and can show that person that, yeah, the project is done, because they're unlikely, I would think, to commit. Nobody's going to commit to buying my tax credit if I've just started construction, because there's no guarantee that I'm going to complete it. So just a little bit of
Representative Ellis.
Okay, so just so I'm following. So the state is still out $100 in both scenarios, because we sold it and that was the tax liability we gave up. But in year one, the investor only made $1. And under the five thing, the investor made 17. So then the question is, at policy level, where are we better off financing the project this way or just paying it outright, like Representative Benz said 20 minutes ago, making an actual allocation to the project from our treasury rather than doing it in this fashion? I mean, I don't know.
Right. And there's another possibility, too, that I've been thinking about. It's not related, I think, to this report, but simply doing the whole thing internally and managing the time value of money and the costs based on these kinds of formulas through the Treasury. And then the whole thing becomes extremely transparent. At that point, because the treasurer is the purchaser and he gets paid back through the budget. Remember, this $100 in the second example isn't paid all at once. We pay it over 5 years. So we don't owe $100 based on current value. It's something less than that. Presumably, it's approximately $83.
And that's a key point, I think, where there seems to be some confusion is the $100 in terms of the state being on the hook for the $100, it's really $20 over 5 years.
Okay. I mean,
and so the fact.
But we still decided that's how we want to do this, right? Like,
those were the decisions that were made. Was it 2009? Is that when it was?
This formula was put in place in 2009.
Did we include that in the 2008 bill that the governor vetoed? I simply don't remember.
Why do we care?
No, that had other constraints on
different issues.
Well, it was a 2009 bill that the governor vetoed. These were passed in that same session. 2008, there were other the bill that passed in that session, the short session, was signed into law. That had other restrictions, largely due to renewable manufacturing projects, the manufacturing bets.
I'm misremembering. He vetoed a bill in 2009, and then we passed another one.
In 2009, there were at least three bills affecting. You had 2472, which is one that was vetoed, which had a lot of restrictions on the Betsy. 2067 moved the sunset dates as part of the larger sunset, tax credit sunset, and then 2068 put these side boards. So those are the three that come to my mind.
Yeah, they sort of blend together after
all. Oh, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Please go ahead. We're running long on this one, but I'll tell you, I think it's worth it to take the time so that members understand. And Representative Whitson, did we answer your question or not? I'm not sure.
Kind of. But I have another question. So the two and the three, the arbitrary three in the five-year tax credit down in the bottom, that, right, so was that trying to guarantee that there was some sort of a set, you talked about it, I don't know how to say this exactly, but that it essentially, to me, gave an advantage to people over the open market, investing in the open market, because you were guaranteeing something as far as the fluctuation of the dollar. Is that correct?
I don't know that I would characterize it that way, because part of the argument that I'm sure you're hearing about is that the price that this formula is determining is too high, that the market is actually a lower price than this, that this price is too high, that it's too costly, so nobody will buy the tax credits. So I don't know that I would phrase it that way. The two and the three are an attempt to recognize in some manner the risk that over 5 years of a taxpayer having sufficient liability over those years. It's a tricky thing to do, to come up with a formula that accurately and represents the efficiency of the market. But it's an attempt to recognize the risk. I mean, the Treasury is trying to mimic, if a taxpayer, they have $1 million that they can invest somewhere. They have a lot of options to them. And one of those is a T-bill, which is pretty safe, or I can buy a tax credit. Those factors, the Treasury yield and the CPI, are getting at two known components of the risk involved in these tax credits. The third risk, not that there are only three of them, is whether or not a corporation or an individual have tax liability over 5 years. I'm not sure how many individuals or businesses can guarantee what their liability will be over 5 years and their ability to use it.
But it's
an attempt to recognize
that. But isn't that part of investing? I mean, we don't know what next year's going to bring, but this thing was guaranteeing something out 5 years instead of allowing it to fluctuate with what other people were doing with
right.
the open market.
It tries okay. to incorporate that. Yeah.
Okay. Right, and that's the same result you had if you bought a five-year treasury. It would it would be based on the current projections for a whole bunch of factors at that
here.
Time. The difference, of course, is that with the five-year treasury, you get your money back whether you have any tax liability or not. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. Chris, back in the napkin, what's the investment return on $83 essentially, and you get $100 at the end of that 5 years. So an investor is going to look at that purchase for $83, know there's essentially $17 of interest they can earn over a period of 5 years. What is that return? Just so I can kind of compare in my mind versus what the T-bill there was for 1.61%.
The interest rate calculation?
Yeah.
I think
maybe we finally hit the stump the Chris
well,
question.
I think that's an interesting question, because the difference between that number and what it actually is tells you what this markup in effect is.
Right.
It gets very complicated being able to look at it. See, this is why I think looking at this thing from a whole bunch of different directions is actually the best way of approaching it. None of them give us a full picture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Could you figure that out for us? I don't mean today, but
yeah. Well, and Mr. Chair, I think you brought up an excellent point, which is, again, the market considers the T-bill the essentially risk-free rate of return. And this is, in a sense, risk-free because you know what you're going to get, although you don't know if you're going to have liability in year four or five. But factoring in that risk, you do know exactly the delta of your return. So the difference between that T-bill and this quote, guaranteed return, even though it's not guaranteed because you may not have a tax liability, would be that market risk and that the other risk factors that we've been discussing. I think. I think I'm understanding the the profile.
I think so, and I also think that that understanding that difference will help us to understand whether the formula that the department came up with is a good formula or not, and whether it needs any adjustment or not. I mean, those are among the things to look at. There's a whole bunch of ways of looking at it. I think we need to look at all of them, and it gets pretty complicated pretty fast, as I hope Chris has illustrated for us today. Go ahead, Chris. Let's get
okay. Just try and wrap.
And now we're getting to the key point of the discussion that's been going on in the newspaper. Please.
Yes. Here is a graphical representation of the 1 year and the 5 year rates. So the blue line are the one year prices, and the red line is the 5 year prices.
These are better for legislators.
Pretty
I'm
going to
take some finance classes. You see, man, next year I'm going to understand all this.
And part of the core issue here is, again, getting back, the way it's structured in statute is that the price is determined at the time of pre-certification. And so you have some projects that you're hearing about that aren't being able to be sold is because their price was set back here at this time period, where the price is basically too high compared to, arguably too high compared to what the market would bear. But since about 2013, they've been fairly stable, where a five-year tax credit would sell for about 80 to 85 cents on the dollar. So in terms, now these numbers are a little bit dated.
Let's back up for a second. I want to discuss this slide a little bit more. I think what you're telling me is that if I got a preliminary certification in, let's say, the first quarter of 13, they would have given me a number, you know, 97, 98%. Based on this graph, as a return that I should expect, I complete my project in the first quarter of 15, 2 years later, and now I go out and try to sell my tax credit, because that's when I have the paper in my hand to go sell it. I'm asking that 97, 98% for it, but the current market is 83. That's the problem, isn't it? For me as a school district, or me as a university, or me as a state agency, the fact is it's not saleable at that rate. Nobody is going to take that much of a bath because current conditions have changed so much.
I think conceptually that's correct, with one minor tweak.
Please be pedantic. I think we need to be.
Because you used the word market there. And part of the debate here, these are the rates that the formula would produce.
Thank you.
Somebody could certainly get into an argument that that's all fine and dandy and that's cute, but that has no bearing on the market of what the tax credits are. And that, so not to split hairs, but that's another layer to some of the debate that has been going on.
And that gets us back to the discussion we had on the previous slide, doesn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly.
Okay.
But your main point stands very much true, is that the formula has been in place, and this is what the state has decided by providing direction to the Department of Energy, and the Department of Energy doing its best to come up with a formula that is clear to everybody. For all of the pros and cons about it, it is what it is, and everybody can understand that. I come in and I get my pre-cert at this time period, then my price is going to be, I can only sell it for 97 cents on the dollar. But if I don't complete it to here, to your exact example, that same formula that was used to calculate my sales price of 97 cents, if I were able to use that formula today, my price would be 82 cents. And so maybe this would help also, if I went in the first quarter of 2014 and got my pre-cert for my five-year tax credit, my price would be 82-83%, whatever this exact number is. And it's roughly been the same since then. Mm-hmm. So the bulk of the tax credits that are in question here kind of got stuck in being handed this sales price, when the formula, the legislatively directed formula, has resulted in a current sales price of around 80-85%. And so there's a timing question there. And to the extent that if one is willing to concede that this formula does reflect the market, then the market has changed, but the sales price isn't being allowed to change in conjunction with the change in the market. again, setting aside that point that I made about.
Well, let's try to get to the market then. Did you examine the values that went into the formula during that period when that red line bumps up high, and so you could understand why that formula returned those numbers, and if you did, can you tell us what those were?
I haven't had the chance to go back to confirm these calculations, but they should be simply different values of T-bills or the CPI.
I mean, this was a time when returns were almost negative, weren't they? So discounts on T-bills would be tiny, even smaller than they are now.
Yeah, I had the time to go back, so I don't know why the formula produced such high amounts here, or I don't know. I can't explain that right now. Yeah. These amounts are just taken from the Department of Energy of what the price was at the time.
Could you do that? Mm-hmm. I mean, because I you're right. I did misspeak about the nature of the red line, about it being a market rather than a formula-based number. But the extent to which it's a real proxy for the market would be a useful thing for us to know.
Right. Sure, I can do that.
Please go ahead. Yeah.
So in terms of the tax credits that are needing a pass-through partner, they're right here. And this partially gets at Rep. Johnson's question about these are the ones that are still in play. I do have a breakdown between the type of the tax credit and the type of entity. So that first table, in total, there are $44 million in tax credits in play. And so if they were sold at 80 cents on the dollar, so $32 million is what they would be sold for, give or take. But they're split between conservation projects and transportation projects. And about half of them, it's split roughly half between government and other entities. Okay. And that bottom table would be an estimate of the $44 million if they were all sold in the same year. The revenue impact over time would be, for the 5 years, 12 million, 12, 7, 6, and 6. And so to get at that cost of what it is for the state in constant dollars, again, these are all nominal dollars, in year one, this $12 million would be worth, you know, maybe $11.5 million in year one. The $7 million here would be worth maybe $6 million. And so each of those, the discount on each of those numbers gets to be more and more over the time period, assuming constant inflation or higher inflation over time. And that's really kind of what gets captured in selling a $100 tax credit for $83, is that $100 is over time. And that $83, the recipient gets that in year one. So arguably, whoever is selling the tax credit is indifferent between, you know, all else being equal, they're indifferent between $100 over 5 years and $83 in year one. That those numbers would be effectively the same.
Representative Whitson.
Yes, I was wondering if you could describe the difference between your conservation and your transportation, what that entails, what projects for those?
A conservation project might be something like weatherizing a building. Mm-hmm. It could be changing the lights to more energy-efficient lights. And transportation, there are two kinds here where you have transit passes, and then you have alternative fuel vehicle infrastructure, basically gas pumps for non-gas, so charging stations for electric cars. Now, having said that, just so everybody's on the same page, the transit pass piece of this is officially sunsetted. There can be no more transit pass projects granted as of January 1st of this year. That was a policy that the 2011 legislature decided to end. But rather than ending at a time period, they phased it out over a few years. So it's really those two. But within these numbers, you have both kinds of projects, transit passes and charging stations, if you will, whatever the alternative fueling stations.
These are the residential and business credits for the installation of a charge point for a car.
Yeah, the thinking there was the state and the feds had tax credits for alternative fuel vehicles, but the problem there, it's kind of a catch-22. You can get all these vehicles out on the road, but if you can't refuel in certain places, then that presents a problem for selling those cars. So the state got rid of the tax credit for alternative fuel vehicles, for electric cars and hybrids, but kept the one for the fueling pumps, the fueling stations. The this infrastructure is the word that statute uses.
Please go ahead. Continue.
One follow-up. So could you identify, for example, a year with year one, year two, year three? When is this done?
Well, right now, I didn't put specific time years on here. Embedded in the current law forecast, I do have assumptions for all of these tax credits and when they've hit. And that can be a complicated model that I put together about when these are all going to hit the stream. Right now, I just pulled it out of years because they haven't been sold yet.
Are those in another report that you've prepared?
Or am preparing.
You are preparing. Yeah. So those will be in another report for us. Okay.
Okay, but the transit, they've been sold.
They're done.
They're done. So that's not part of.
Well, that. There are some transit projects in here. And in part of the $20 million for transportation projects are some transit passes. No new ones can be issued. So there would be a transit agency that earned this credit in 2012, 2013, 2014. They haven't been able to sell it. They're never going to use it. They're a non-taxable entity. But they haven't been able to sell it because the formula is producing a price that is too high. Or we're not the market is not finding any buyers for these tax credits at that price.
So how long do we give them then? Indefinitely to sell those? Or
no, there's a – and I'll have to refresh my memory. There's a time period before they just go away. If they're not sold by a certain time, they're just gone. And I'd have to refresh my memory on what that is.
Thank you.
Eventually, they get to the point where they could become a one-year credit, don't they?
Well, the 5 years is supposed to start whenever the final cert. So that right. 5 years doesn't get collapsed. So if they were sold, even if the...
Well, it does not get collapsed.
Right, does not get collapsed. The 5 years starts...
When do you use them?
The year in which the final certification... Final certification, so these are...
Suppose I'm able to sell it in year six. Would the taxpayer then be able to use all of it at once?
No.
In year six, because the 5 years has passed?
Their 5 years starts when they buy it.
Thank you. So these are a wasting asset in the sense that when the... As that period of carry forward goes, the value of them declines naturally by the number of years that are left. In the carry forward.
So that's what we're doing.
I think so. I'm not sure I followed exactly.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Well, we'll talk about that later. Representative Davis, did you have something?
Yes, thank you, Chair. And I think you may have answered this, but when you said these tax credits are out there, that means they are projects that have been completed, but they're held by entities that don't have liability or can't have liability, and they're waiting to be sold? Is that what you meant by out there?
Okay. Yes, that's...
And one of the reasons why we're spending time on this is I expect that the distinct possibility that we may be faced with a policy decision about whether we're going to try to do something to change the formula for these credits that are in that period on the slide with the two different colored lines where the red line and the blue line intersect, and that. There's a whole lot of considerations in all directions on that, something for us not to discuss today, but just to be aware that part of the reason why we're having this conversation is so that when we get to that, we'll already have some background. I'm sorry. Oh, I'm sorry. I stole part of your thunder. Okay. Please.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So, right, the $44 million, and this number is a couple months old right now. So what's before the legislature, you have this pot of tax credits that, as Rep. Davis just described, they're waiting to be sold. You also have, so that's kind of an existing pot of tax credits. You also have tax credits that could come into play throughout 16 and throughout 17 that could be affected by any legislative changes in February. So my last slide would be policy options for the legislature this February. The first is to make no statutory change. You heard from legislative counsel that there aren't any legal problems with statute as it currently exists. The second possibility, and this might be the easiest, is to change the timing of the formula from the pre-certification date to the final certification date. And I'm speaking a little bit loosely there, but it would be the date of sale, the final certification isn't actually granted until it's sold. So you can't actually set the price of final certification because that doesn't have till after it's sold. But it would be that concept. And that would be a simple statutory change. Third would be to allow private transactions to basically let them be sold whatever they for what they can be sold. And you can do this with a minimum price or without a minimum price. You can basically allow market transactions and include a floor for what might be acceptable. The fourth is to create a new formula. Now, this could be complicated and could take more time than you have in February, and because it would be replicating that process that Energy used to build that formula and basically recreate that and try to get at the market or whatever would be politically acceptable for that sales price. And the last one is to simply purchase unsold tax credits. And this could be done directly or indirectly. Okay. So that the $44 million that are sitting out there, if those entities collectively are expecting, say, $30 million for those tax credits, because the value is $44 million and they want to sell them for $30 million, then the state could simply either directly or indirectly spend the $30 million on to those entities and basically buy back those tax credits at the transfer rate
and
price.
Save the $14 million in taxes.
Save the $14 million in taxes.
Representative. Okay, so can I assume that if at the point that we start to consider any of these, someone's going to lay out for me what this does to our general fund? Like if we were going to collect $1 million, instead we're only going to collect, you know, 900,000, you know,
be confident that Representative Buckley and Senator Devlin are extremely interested in the actions of the Revenue Committee and the Finance and Revenue Committee as they pertain to things that affect the general fund.
And then,
the answer is yes.
Okay, and then my follow-up question is, and the reason why we would want to, I mean, obviously I want to know how much we're going to collect or lose, but part of making changes is to make these investment options either more or less attractive. That's also part of what's in play here for somebody out there that wants to buy.
Part of the policy question that we face gets back to that issue of do they trust us? And so I think the way you stated it is a pretty good one. If we make no change and these are not sold at all, then this will negatively affect the balance sheets, the budgets, and so forth of the various entities that expected to be able to sell them and can't now. And they also will affect the state's ability to engage in these kinds of transactions in the future, because they will reduce the sense of our reliability as a partner in the process. So. Yeah, I mean, there's probably a lot of different ways of saying it, but I think that's the general answer.
Go ahead.
Thanks. So, actually, on that question, I don't know a huge amount about tax credit, but my impression in other contexts is that it might be a source of construction funding, right? So if you are going to build the solar panels atop your nonprofit, you get your allocation, and it's on your pro forma as a source of money that you are hopefully going to get, but you don't use it until you have at least a contract for the purchase of those credits, subject to satisfaction of different things like you build the project. But so, I mean, I think we're fundamentally in a different spot. I mean, the tool that we've given out is an optimistic hope of getting someone to buy your tax credits for a certain amount of money. And I would assume most business people haven't spent that allocation until they had someone contract to buy it. So it's not like someone built a solar facility and then was hoping that they would get, that they'd be able to sell the tax credits, right? I mean, so it's not exactly the same. It's not as
speculative.
It's a more speculative tool than I feel like your characterization just described, because people, what they have is a hopeful interest in being able to get someone to buy the thing that they had an allocation in, and I'm sure that they want to be able to sell it, but my impression, unless I've got it wrong, is not that they had a guarantee that for sure someone would sell it at X price, and therefore the state should come in and take out that expectation. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
I think that's fair. The school district that does put solar panels on ahead of time, they know they can get, from statute, they know that that project will award them a credit that is worth $1 million over 5 years. Now, they could have gone into it with a local business partner, and the business partner said, a local business said, well, we'll buy the tax credit. Mm-hmm. And it certainly could be the case that at the outset, they said, well, we'll pay for it at this price, and you'll be good to go. So you'll have that certainty.
Right.
A lot of the other ones, though, those would be examples of projects where they're coming in with, well, I know who my pass-through partner is, and when it comes to fruition, I'm going to sell it. And so there's more certainty around that. But there are obviously a lot of projects that it's kind of, well, we're hoping that we can sell $1 million. We'll put it out on the market and hope that somebody can buy it. That can factor into a lot of things. The economy not going into recession is something that's going to factor into there, because you're going to need a strong economy and strong businesses with potential tax liability to use the tax credit. But I think the characterization certainly fits a lot of these projects where they were hoping to sell it, and maybe they were counting on something. Maybe they got some bad advice or good advice on their ability to sell it. I mean, it can be all over the map there between a guaranteed seller and I have no idea who I'm going to sell it to, because a lot of these entities would go to the Department of Energy and say, I can't find somebody to buy it. You need to find somebody to buy it for me. And probably shouldn't have phrased it that way, because I want to stay away from some of those potential issues. But
yeah,
it's a whole other issue. I think we'll spend a fair amount of time. If we get this question as a policy issue for us, we'll spend a fair amount of time on exactly the question that Representative Leininger is asking, in order for us to tease out individually and as a committee what we think the policy ought to be. I don't think we're there yet. But the problem has been stated for us by the department and others, and we have to decide what, if anything, we want to do about it and what the reasons might be for that decision. I don't think we're going to get there today, and if it's okay, I think Representative Helm has another question, maybe on a different topic.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It would be helpful to me when we get back around to this to have sort of the skeleton of an actual energy project financial transaction, because...
Or maybe a couple.
Yeah, because my sense is that these projects are big, capital intensive. Nobody has all the money necessary all at once. And so we're leveraging all these little pots of money, of which the tax credits are only a small part, to actually play in global capital markets. And so it would help me to understand whether we're deep on that side, the realities of those financial transactions. So that's one piece. The other gets to... back to a question that Representative Johnson asked about who's holding the tax credits still. Yeah. And not just broke down between nonprofits and so forth, but I'm also interested in how many of the tax credits are still held by the project developers, if any. And I may misunderstand that. It seems like some could. That if we're changing the terms of the deal with those people midstream, that's a different fairness question to me than if we're changing the terms of the deal for speculative investors or folks that have tax liabilities that have bought these tax credits on the open market. Two different questions and two different expectations.
Let me deal with a piece of that. I don't think anybody has suggested the second half of that. I don't know that anybody has suggested that once a tax credit is sold, we ought to affect the value of it, with the possible exception of the comment that I made when we heard about this issue earlier, having to do with extra legal sales, when I suggested that maybe what we may want to do is claw back some money. I got criticized for that comment, but it would be the opposite, I think, of what you're suggesting in that case. I don't think anybody is suggesting that somehow or another we should go back to people who've already purchased tax credits and say, no, we overcharged you. I don't think anybody's suggesting that.
Good.
Real question about that.
Thank you.
Representative Whitsitt.
So was the expectation that capital gains taxes were paid on the difference between a credit and what it was sold for to the state? So say you had something valued at $1 million, you sold it for $700,000, $300,000, was somebody supposed to pay capital gains on that, and did they?
Could we defer that? I think that's a really important question, but it's a capital gains question rather than a question for this. It is a piece of the discussion about the policy when we get to it. And thank you very much for raising it. I think it's an important question. I'm aware that we're really pressed for time this morning, and I'd like to have Chris stick that on his list of questions to look into. It gets pretty complicated pretty fast. But thank you. I think that's a very important question. We have several other items. Representative Johnson.
Well, just a larger, I guess, philosophical question that may not be for this committee to delve into, but it gets into my question earlier about the breakdown between the number of credits that have gone to actual private sector entities who would have tax liability versus non-governmental or non-private sector or government, nonprofits, whatever. Because it really seems that if you take a holistic view of this, what the question is, should the state, i.e. the government here, be trying to incentivize behaviors by other governmental agencies, i.e. school districts, cities, counties, whatever, to engage in certain types of behavior? And in doing so, knowing that we're going to create an environment where there's going to have to be this trading going on because they can't directly apply it to a tax liability. But it even goes more than that, because I think we set up a sense of a false economy. I'll use the school district example. We have a project we want to do in our school district. It involves energy. We know we can get tax credits for that. That'll buy down the cost of that to our local taxpayers. We sell them on that. What we don't tell them, though, is that that tax credit's going to result in less money coming into the general fund on the back end that actually pays for the teachers and the products and everything in that school district as well. We don't often look at it holistically about this. We're only looking at that individual transaction. And I think that's the message that I think the state of Oregon really needs to have, and we need to have. Does it make sense for the government to incentivize behaviors on the part of another governmental entity? Because that's what creates a lot of this problem. And we start looking at the hundreds of millions of dollars that were in play here over the course of this time frame. We're not just talking peanuts.
Right. Thank you. Let me comment on that question, because I think that is probably half of the core question. The point of this exercise at all was to move the state of Oregon along on the transition mm-hmm. from fossil fuel use and from inefficiency in energy use to efficient energy use and sustainable energy production. That's what the point of this was to start with. The question that you're raising is a really important one, and that is, okay, how do we get there? How do we, assuming even that that ought to be our policy, which I personally believe it should be, how do we get there? Is this mechanism a piece of that? Let me make one additional comment. In 2007, when we significantly expanded some of these alternatives, and I was on the committee then, I was the chair of the committee then, the staff people who were sitting here talking about this were here then. We thought we were adopting a very small tax credit amounting to about $12 million a year. It turned out that because of the lack of sideboards in the initial bill, that it turned out to be much, much higher than that, the kind of numbers we're looking at today. So the struggle for this committee and for the legislature has been, how do we regain control over this bill that we passed in 2007? The 2008 bill, the three 2009 bills, one of which was vetoed, were all related to the issue, and the 2011 bill were all related to the issue of how do we gain control over this process. I think you're asking a key question as a policy matter, and it's interrelated with what the goal is. If the goal's a good goal, that answers the first part of the question. If it's not, then we shouldn't be involved in this stuff at all. If it is a good goal, the goal of increasing efficiency in energy use and and switching from fossil fuels to renewables for energy production, if that's a good goal, then the question is this a mechanism that we want to use? Our answers from 2008 on have been a lot less, please, than what we've been doing. This is a continuation of that discussion, and some members of the committee are coming into the middle of it. So I think it's important to understand the background. It's also important for the committee to make its own determination on both of those questions. I welcome the question. We're not going to get there today, and if we could, I would really like to get on to our next item. Can we do that? Thank you, Chris. I appreciate it very much, and I'm going to apologize to the Secretary of State Audit Division for holding them up and move on to the delinquent debt collection audit report. Thank you. And Chris, Paul, you were right. Our agenda was jam-packed even without that other item.
That's exactly right. That's true.
Do you all know where the presentation is on here?
Can someone help her set up the presentation? There is an audit report in the material, meeting materials, if that's what you're referring to.
They have a presentation.
Well, they have a presentation also.
Yes.
Okay. That should be in there, but it maybe isn't.
Yeah, it's PP.
Well, they have a separate PowerPoint. Would you see that it gets into the meeting materials later so that other people can look at it?
It's not all this.
Oh, yes, it's called PPP2.
Thank you.
And if you would state your name for the record and then go ahead and give your testimony, we'd appreciate that.
All righty, thank you. It's Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Sandra Hilton. I'm an audit manager at the Oregon State Audits Division and was the audit manager for this particular project. With me today is Jamie Rawls, who is the in-charge auditor for this project. We're very happy to be here today and be able to provide with you the results of our project. I'll turn it over to Jamie here.
Good morning. As Sandy mentioned, my name's Jamie Rawls. I was the lead auditor for this audit, and I'm going to get right into giving you guys a presentation on what the audit was about. So we were asked to come present on the audit. I thought today would be helpful to give a little bit of background, which was covered in the audit on debt and collections, provide an overview of the performance audit, summarize the audit findings. We want to give a little bit of an overview of Senate Bill 55, which addressed a lot of the audit recommendations and findings we had in the audit, but not all, and then cover recommendations that are still left outstanding. After that, Senate Bill 55 went through and any others, and then go through collection tools we had covered in the audit that we thought would be useful, as well as information from other states. And as I'm going along, feel free to ask any questions or stop me as needed. So we released the audit. It was titled Oregon Needs Stronger Leadership, Sustained Focus to Improve Delinquent Debt Collection, last September 2015. This was our sixth audit involving collections since 1997, and that's important because we had identified many audit findings that had not been resolved for many, many years. It was like history had almost repeated itself, and we were uncovering some of the same findings we had going back to 1997, and I'll get to those in a little bit. It's a good distinction to make as our audit began at the Department of Revenue and used some of the Department of Revenue data and information, but it included eight other large creditor agencies or debt-holding agencies of the state in addition to DOR. So we expanded it out. We did not just focus on tax debt, and I'll get into more detail of that. Also important, we did not see quick fixes that would immediately bring in tens of millions of dollars into the state. We made that point clear in the audit report. It was improving collections is difficult. It involves the way we do it here in the state of Oregon is decentralized, a lot of agencies doing a lot of different things, complex legal issues, different mechanisms, different tools, and rapidly changing technology. So it's a lot of things happening at once. And those things are going to have to be addressed that way to get fixed. During the audit, we did become aware of Senate Bill 55, which was drafted by the Institute for Modern Government at Willamette University. We met with them many times, and at the point when that was introduced, we realized there was a lot of issues that were being covered in that Senate bill that we knew a lot about at the time of the audit, but we weren't at the point where we could release our audit report. So we actually did something we haven't done in the past, and or have, but not in this manner. We issued an interim report to the legislator. We came and presented on our audit with what we could say at the time and helped to provide some input on that and what findings we were uncovering at the audit so that they could possibly be incorporated into that Senate bill. It addressed a lot of the recommendations while others remain. So again, I'll go into those in a minute. This is just a background backdrop. Oregon's delinquent debt rose from $1.7 billion at the end of fiscal year 2008 to $3.2 billion in 2014. At the same time, during that time frame, collection rates dropped from 13.5 to 11.2. And the state's general fund portion of that, or tied to the general fund, is about $800 million. We found that based on agency management estimates, about half of the $3.2 million in delinquent debt may be uncollectible. So that's an important note, too. At 2014 debt levels, though, every percentage point increase in the collection rate could bring in another $38 million. If we had gone back to had collected delinquent debt at a 13.5% rate in 2014, which it was last achieved in 2008, we could have brought in, as a state, nearly $90 million more in collections. So Oregon law requires agencies to assign or send debt at 90 days past due or liquidated to either Department of Revenue or other agency accounts. So the other agency accounts unit is where we did a lot of a focus of our audit. And that is what we have in Oregon is the most centralized function of a debt collection unit that we have. They get all the agency's debt gets sent to them, and then also private collection firms. Statewide agencies report making 94% of the liquidated and delinquent debt collection themselves. OAA and PCFs, so private collection firms, account for about 6% of the total collections. And that makes sense. A lot of the debt, debtors are going to pay the entity they dealt with first. Rather than paying a separate entity. In general, OAA and PCFs also have considerably lower collection rates than the agencies themselves. They get the older debt. So the agencies have an opportunity to try and collect the debt first, and then if uncollected by 90 days. And again, that liquidated and delinquent point, delinquency is, you know, obviously not being paid by the due date, and then the liquidated portion is having the debtor have a chance to contest it. So that's what we focused on. And the OAA and PCFs get older debt. OAA and PCFs hold about $1.3 billion of the state's $3.2 billion liquidated and delinquent debt. This is as of June 2014 from the LFO report. Private collection firms hold nearly $1 billion of the state's debt. This is more than double of the 2008 balance. And they have a collection rate of just over 1%. So that's another important note. The entity that is getting the most of the debt is the entity that does the poorest with the collection rate. And I think we've maybe seen the pendulum swing back and forth widely over the years, which is why one of our recommendations is for the state to be monitoring the collection rates better, tracking the collection rates better, and that would help. So data suggests that OAA may outperform private collection firms. It's roughly six times the collection rate of PCFs. So go ahead. Oh.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But does that also mean that their collection rate is 6% if the private firms is 1% and the OAA is six times, but it's still only 6%?
So Chair Barnhart and Representative Warner, yes, the collection rate is about 7% at OAA and 1% at the private collection firms.
Thank you.
We did a study.
And the denominator here is 100% of the debt owed.
Correct.
Okay.
So during the audit, we kept hearing, you know, well, the reason why the private collection firms have a lower collection rate is they get the oldest debt. And to an extent, that is true. We tried to study it a little bit in the audit, and we took the state's largest debtor, which is the Judicial Department. And they're pretty good about using private collection firms. They are one of the agencies that are monitoring collection rates. They send their debt both to OAA at Department of Revenue as well as private collection firms. So it was a good study for us. We took debt that was 2 years or older and looked at it at each age class, and in fact found that OAA did outperform the private collection firms at every age class. So even looking at the oldest debt, at every age class, they outperformed them. I believe their collection rate was about 1.6 to 3 times higher than OJD's best private collection firm. So an overall audit findings overview, what the audit was about was in the past, in a lot of our audits over the years, we had focused on a lot of the little issues, and well, not little issues, but maybe not the big picture. And this time we felt like we needed to raise it up, look at what's really the cause, the root cause of what's going on. And really it came down to Oregon hasn't focused on improving debt collections over the years. We find we do an audit, there's a lot of excitement, there's a lot of talk, things may get implemented, and then it dies down. And then we go in and do an audit maybe 3 or 4 years later, and we feel like we're starting from ground zero again. There's no one single entity to go to ask questions, to get a feel for what the landscape is, what's going on. And so we really took it at that level during the audit on our audit findings. And I'll go into that point in a little bit. The other big issue was performance reporting, and the measurements are flawed. So as you all are probably aware, all the agencies have to submit their delinquent and liquidated debt to the Legislative Fiscal Office in a report that's compiled every year. We looked at that audit report or at that report in great depth and found it was flawed. There was a lot of errors. It's good in its intention, and I think it could serve a purpose if it was used a little more and if it could be expanded upon. And what that was part of our recommendations is that DAS could do a little bit more with that report. But we found even the most simplistic collection rates by agencies are not contained in that report. We could calculate those with the detail that the agencies were submitting over but wasn't getting published. But that collection rates were not in there. Trends over time were not in there. Things that you would expect to be able to see to ask more questions, why did the collection rate go down, why did it go up, were not being contained in there. Caseload, collection caseload by agencies, which is, you know, key to collecting, is not included in there. And delinquency rate, which measures how much of the actual debt is going delinquent, was not contained in the report. So that could definitely be improved. We also found Oregon's not using proven collection tools other states are using, and I'll go into those in a little bit, and that we need more sophisticated data analysis. What we found in looking at all the agencies and interviewing them was a lot of them are doing one-on-one lookups. So they have a debtor sitting in front of them. They type them in. They go to this system, look at it. They go to this system and look at it. Mm. There's ways they could be tapping into that a little bit better and taking data sets and matching it 100% and looking at it and being better at that. Other states are doing more of that. And we think that Gentax at Department of Revenue actually has the capability and is a good thing and can do that. And so we're hopeful. The audit didn't focus on Gentax, but we did, you know, do our due diligence and looked at, you know, how that was being implemented, what it was capable of. And a lot of our recommendations, we feel like they could build upon it, and it's really a good thing if they implement that all the way. Going into the focus on improving collections, we found, again, that other states had an enterprise-wide authority with strategic reporting responsibilities. So other states also had centralized collections. So there was a distinction. Some states had centralized collections and an oversight that was centralized. Other states, like Oregon, had more of a decentralized collection function but had a mechanism that oversaw those functions, and that's where we addressed some of the recommendations of our audit. They were consistently pursuing new collection tools and reviewing results. I think one of the handouts that we had sent ahead of time, and I don't know if you all have looked at it, is a report from Wisconsin. We think it's an excellent example. In 1 year, they pursued 7 different legislative actions on collections. They are constantly looking at new tools that are coming available, tweaking things they've already implemented, looking at things, measuring, and it has all the information laid out in there, and we received their permission to share it. So I think that's a great, good look to see where Oregon could go.
And that is posted in OLIS for today's materials.
Yes.
For the members of the committee and the public. Please go ahead.
And we found that these other states rely on monitoring, discussion, and reporting to encourage compliance from agencies. So none of them had that, iron fist they could force agencies to do anything. But that reporting mechanism was key, because by calling out agencies that are doing poorly in a report, showing their collection rate has dropped and holding them accountable, or on the positive end, that it had gone up and they were doing something unique, that was the key there. So specific to Department of Revenue, we had some, they weren't completely the focus of our audit, but they were incorporated as the entity, and we spent a lot of time there. We found that in 2004, we conducted an audit, and we looked at 5 different agencies. And back then, in 2004, we found that Oregon, our OAA unit, had the highest caseload of all the agencies. Again, this time around, we again found they had the highest caseload of all the agencies that we looked at. They also had about 4,700 debt accounts per collection agents. So that's pretty high. And it's considerable. I mean, they're doing as well as they are, considering that.
Can you say that number again?
4,700 debt accounts per collection agent.
1 to 4,700.
4,700.
Thank you.
Yes.
I'll remember that number.
And we found that they are not making phone calls on more than half of the accounts within 30 days of receiving a debt, or on about a quarter within 90 days. So again, those phone calls are crucial in debt collection world, and they were not doing that. We also found that tax debtor data is not always shared or collected. So for example, the other agency accounts gets all the debt from different agencies they send to them. They were not collecting the original delinquency date of the debt, which you would think would be important in being able to prioritize which debts you pursue. So they were getting the date that it was transferred to them, but not the original delinquency date, something they could ask for and collect quite easily if they would pursue that, and they probably are now. They weren't sharing data also back to the entities. So a lot of times the debt would come to them, and they would find out things in pursuing collections on that debt. And then if they couldn't collect on it, then at a certain point, I think it's a year, it goes back to the agency. They weren't sharing that information back. So then again, the agency is starting from ground zero and doesn't have the information that was already collected. And it comes to the other way. So there's times when the agency may have more information, such as a debtor address, and all they send over is the SSN and the debt amount. So there's things that could be shared back and forth so that the wheel is not being, recreated. Senate Bill 55 included several audit recommendations. So again, it assigned DAS with the monitoring, that direct oversight of debt collections, to provide technical assistance to agencies, develop performance standards, and provide training. Improve performance reporting, including the quality and value of data submitted to LFO. So that should help in that performance measurement and that LFO report being a little more accurate. Submit an annual management report. So we didn't want to change the LFO report because there's already a mechanism set up for how agencies report that information. But we thought, there's still, it needs to be built upon. So if DAS can do a management report that takes what's been submitted by the agencies and build upon that, include the collection rate, include trends, information that was right there or easily could get and look at that in a little more detail and provide some discussion on it. And then to adopt policies to describe when a state agency may request Social Security numbers in accordance with state and federal law. This is a big thing in our state. It comes up in our audits. It comes up in our audit work. We hear it at the agencies. The whole Privacy Act with the Social Security number, sometimes we're paralyzed by that. And so being able to share SSNs in accordance with the law, other states do it, this played into the state not being able to do a vendor offset. We found that in our audit, the state has debtors who we are actually paying out quite a bit of money to on the vendor side. And they are not doing that because they feel like the Social Security number, they can't match that because you haven't given the debtor or the individual the notice that that could be used for debt collection. So this is something that can be, it was addressed into Senate Bill 55. We're hopeful that that will help that.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Davis.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much. Can you describe the mechanics of why that's not happening? Because from my perspective, let's just take Department of Revenue. Clearly, they're getting the EIN or the SSN for a tax return, so we know what a tax liability is. And if the state's making a vendor payment, they require a W-9, which correspondingly right. would require an SSN or an EIN. So where's the disconnect in on either side of that transaction, the taxpayer identification number not being obtained?
So Representative Barnhart and Rep. Davis, that is interesting because we do collect Social Security number on both sides.
Yeah.
The Privacy Act, though, requires us to notify the individual where we requested the Social Security number how we will use that Social Security number specifically. So even though we're getting it on the tax side, we are not telling them or getting their permission or notifying them that that SSN will be used for tax collection purposes. And because of that, we are paralyzed from doing that match.
On the vendor side. When we obtain the W-9, we're not
EIN,
yeah, we're not correspondingly providing them the required notification that that could be used to collect a liability
right.
from another division of the state.
Right, exactly. So then vendors are captured by a DAS, and then the debt side or the tax side is at the agencies, and so they feel like they can't share that information to make that match.
And in your report, or in your comments today, I think you're going to include some of the things that the legislature might do to make this process work better.
Right. Yes. Right.
And that, well, I'm assuming that that changes in the statute that would allow for these kinds of interactions to take place is among those recommendations.
Right.
Frank, thank you. Yeah. I want to try to restrict questions because we're under a huge time bind this morning. I would like to get at least a little bit into the other items as well.
If
we could. So if a question gets asked that you're going to get to later, please say that, and we'll get to it later.
Sure. So here's a list you guys are probably interested in of the tools that Oregon, we found during the audit, was not using. State vendor offset. So I just spoke to that. We believe that is authorized now with the use of SSNs. It's authorizing if you have a debt and you have a vendor, you can offset that payment and pay off your debt. I think agencies were scared. They didn't know what the law, if they could do that or not. And then the SSN issue. So I believe that is authorized. Now they need to implement it in Senate Bill 55. Bank levies, this is something, it's in the Wisconsin report. I believe that Wisconsin was getting about 15% of their total collections, about $30 million a year from bank levies. And this is a collection tool where right now agencies have to guess where a debtor may be banking. They may have a canceled check and they have then some clear information that that they're banking at this entity, and they can then file a levy and then or garnishment and get that money to pay the debt. If they don't have that canceled check, they're guessing. There's money and time and cost involved in submitting these requests out to all these banks. Other states are doing this a lot more better. They are doing it electronically where they automatically send a list of the debtors to the banking entities. They do the match sometimes by a third party, send the results back. It's automated. The money is taken from the bank account. And I believe Rep. Taylor is proposing this this session. There's also a new hire report, and this is under federal law, employers are required to submit within 20 days to the Department of Justice. This was implemented for child support all across the nation, any lists of new hires who's been recently hired. Some agencies have been able to use this to help and aid in their collections. We had found Department of Revenue had been trying to get access to this new hire report for years. and had been hitting a black hole at the Department of Justice and could not seem to get the reasons why they couldn't get it. I believe that this is also being proposed and was quickly able to be worked out from what I hear with some attention to it. It's going to be proposed in 2016 again by Rep. Taylor. There's also a statewide lien registry. This was proposed in the last session. It was Senate Bill 56. It did not pass, but this we felt like was a I don't know all the nuances. We don't get into all the nuances with what the reasonings were why that didn't pass. But we felt like it was a great tool that other states are using, where now agencies have to go to multiple counties, up to 36 counties, and file their liens. There could be a one-stop shop for the liens registry where you could go. I think the counties were concerned about loss of revenue. We had heard maybe there was ways to work that out. So that was another tool that other states are using that would help. I'll go into the other these other things here quickly. Just covered the statewide lien registry. Again, the internet, so internet posting of debtors. 23 states are maintaining a public online list of debtors, some focused only on large debtors, some only focused on business debtors. There's lots of ways different states are doing it. Many of the debtors we found paid just after receiving the warning letter. I believe one state we met with said they had one debtor pay, it was some in the millions on one debt just from receiving the letter and didn't want it to be public. The amount of posting varies. California posts the top 500, Washington posts 10,000 or above, and Georgia and Indiana post all. There is privacy concerns. The data must be accurate. And we find many of the states that implemented this, they remove the debtor once the debtor makes contact and sets up a payment plan. So it can be very effective. Wisconsin, the report that I shared, has they had $12 million in collections for the last fiscal year, 2013-14, attributable to internet posting. Oregon DOR, I believe, is doing this now. I believe they have decided to do a pilot on this to see the top 50 business debtors and the top 50 tax debtors, individual debtors, and sending out a letter, and they have 30 days to respond, and we're hopeful that that will bring in some good results. I believe the legislature would need to make any statutory...
Just a moment, Representative Davis.
Well, just a note that although I think this might strike some people as publishing information, private information publicly, tax liens are filed in the public records on a daily basis already for income tax liens.
That answers a question that I was sharing with Paul.
Yeah.
They're recorded if you're going to file them in the county clerk's records,
right,
then they're public information anyway, and this simply makes them more easily available to the public.
Chair Barnhart, Rep. Davis. Yeah, that's the case. Since they felt like they already had the authority to do this. Now, if this would be broadened out to other debt, that would need to have some statutory changes.
Okay.
So, like, this would not include OAA, I don't believe, because that's not tax debt. That's coming from other agencies.
Mm-hmm.
So, other states are always also doing lottery winning offset. This is just as it sounds, offsetting lottery winnings against debt. Maryland reports about $1.2 million a year, so not the biggest tool, but again, one of the available tools in their toolbox and makes collections go up. We have two collection units, and we surveyed all of our collection units that are reporting matching debtors to lottery. I believe it is OPAR, which is at the Oregon Health Authority, and they collect on behalf of DHS and OHA, and then also Department of Justice, and those were the only two that were doing that. Increasing this would require legislation. I believe those two entities had the authority to do that through legislation. Incarceration listings, again, we found Employment Department has worked with county sheriffs and other state prisoner records, developed a list of people in Oregon jails or prisons, using that for their unemployment program, but also for collections. And again, this is another area where we find one agency doing something really unique and great, but not being shared across the board with all the other agencies, and we're hoping DAS can help that. Unclaimed property. The Department of State Lands maintains the unclaimed property list. We found agencies are doing little matching of this, but other states are doing more of this. DOR had started a kind of a pilot doing this on their own and had, at the date of the end of our audit, it seemed like they were getting some useful results with this. So they have to do a match to the unclaimed property list. If they identify some unclaimed property that is on one of their debtors, they can file a claim to get it, to pay the debt. So again, it's just another tool that seems useful that other agencies aren't using. And basic just warning letters. We found states that we spoke with were using different approaches with well-timed warning letters to and tracking the results of that. When we did the audit, we found that DOR sends an early notice for tax debt that, hey, if you don't pay this tax debt, it's going to get transferred to a private collection firm. There's going to be added fees, et cetera. And they send that really early out in the process, but not right before it gets transferred. So maybe again, right before it gets transferred as the last kind of letter that goes out that you have this last chance to pay it or you're going to get extra fees added on. Other states seem to be doing that a little bit more and experimenting with that. So this slide is just to give you a gauge of what our previous audit recommendations had found. A lot of these we found again in this audit. So implement vendor offset, that's from 1997. Still had not been implemented at the time of our audit. Expand access to reports of new hires, still had not been implemented. Increase access to collection tools. Address insufficient staffing and large caseloads. We're still finding areas where there's, you know, large caseloads. And again, reporting that caseload amount in a report would be helpful. So you can look at the different agencies, see the ones that have high caseloads and make adjustments. Improve evaluation of private collection firms. DAS gets all the collection firms' contracts. They were not monitoring the results of how the private collection firms were doing with the debt. Implement a statewide accounts receivable performance measure. I believe only three of the state's top debt-holding agencies have a key performance measure related to collection. And then periodically review written-off accounts. We found agencies that had, one in particular, the largest amount of debt written off in the state and wasn't even aware of why. Going forward, we're hoping that this lays the groundwork for the annual management report that DAS can do and make that more useful tool to go along with the LFO report. Help agencies adopt proven collection tools, keep a handle on what's happening with all the different agencies, and get the word out to all of them when a useful tool becomes available or one agency finds a unique way of doing something. Improve the debt data so that it's reliable and becomes accurate. And prepare for a sustained effort. So it needs continual focus, not just right now, as we go forward.
Questions.
Any questions?
Thank you. I'd like to keep questions brief just so we can get on to the other items today. I want to say that I really appreciate the work that the Audit Division does. This is the kind of report that can easily earn the state back everything we spend on the audit division for several years all in one fell swoop if we follow the recommendations. This committee probably is only involved in a small number of these recommendations you've made, but I do know that Representative Taylor's bill is going to be going to the committee that works with government efficiency issues. As we continue to do our part, it would be really useful for us to know the specific issues where we can be helpful. There may be some privacy issue changes that we can make and so forth, but a lot of this is done in other committees. Right. Finally, I'd say to the committee, if you know anybody on Ways and Means, talk to them about these numbers. 4,700 in the Department of Revenue. That's a budget problem. I can't imagine that cutting that number in half wouldn't pay for itself easily over and over again. Anything else? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Let's go on to are the people here for the University Venture Development Fund here?
No,
we told them 10-4. Okay, well, let's go ahead then with the 9:30 item, Understanding Oregon's Cost Performance Method of Apportioning Corporate Income Tax, Department of Revenue.
I could just say something.
Yes, Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason why we're bringing this to you, this was an issue that you looked at before. It came up in particular in the context of Measure 67 in 2009, and then because of the use of the gross Oregon sales And one of the things that I don't think was widely understood at the time is that the way this current law works under our apportionment formula is we treat service corporations much differently than we do tangible goods corporations in terms of the sales factor and how Oregon sales are measured. So we had asked, actually, in 2010, Department of Revenue to come brief the committee, and they went through explained how that operates under current law. And we've asked them to come back, update that report to you, because there's some initiatives out there that might make this issue extremely important.
Thank you. And appreciate your coming today. And the first bad news is, instead of the time that we thought you had, you really only have about 40 minutes.
That's all right. That's not a problem. For the record, I'm Deanna Mack with Department of Revenue, and I have been asked to go over a very complex subject today, corporate apportionment, specifically the cost of performance method of apportioning income. This is a complex tax issue, and we've tried to make it very simple and understandable, but if at any point you have questions, please feel free to stop me and ask. I thought I brought my corporate tax manager, Don Jones, with me. I think he might not be here. I don't know. To answer any specific questions. Oh, yay, he is here. Good. Relief. answer any specific questions you guys have about the program. But first, I wanted to give you a little bit of history about the corporate apportionment. In 1957, state tax officials adopted the Uniform Division of Income for Tax Purposes Act, and you'll hear us call it UDIPA, which is a model law for apportioning the income of a corporation that is taxable in two or more states. The intent of this UDIPA was to provide uniformity among the states. Many states, including Oregon, adopted the general provisions of both the 1957 version of UDIPA and the Multi-State Tax Commission regulations interpreting that law. Oregon adopted it in 1965, the 1957 version of that law, and it's remained largely unchanged over time. The 1957 UDIPA provisions address the sourcing of sales of tangible personal property or goods using a market approach, along with provisions that address the sourcing of sales and income from intangible property using the cost of performance method. Customer location is significant when determining Oregon sales of tangible personal property, which recognizes a contribution to the market state, whereas the cost of performance method of determining sales recognizes where the service is performed, regardless of where the service is consumed. Under the 1957 version of UDIPA, sales of services are Oregon sales if the income producing activity is performed in Oregon or both in and outside of Oregon, with the greater proportion of the income producing activity performed in Oregon based on their cost of performance. It's a greater proportion. The 1957 version of UDIPA cost of performance method is an all or nothing approach, that is applied to each item of sales revenue from services. When a taxpayer performs an income producing activity in connection with an item of sales revenue in more than one state, whichever state has the greater proportion of the cost of performance of the activity will be assigned all of the sales related to that item for income tax purposes for the sales factor. The greater proportion does not require a majority of the costs. It just needs to be the greatest of all of the states, and then more than any other state, and then it goes to that state. Although in the past, the cost of performance method has been standard for many states, for several years there has been a trend among the states to move away from the cost of performance method of apportionment to a market-based approach. In simplest terms, a market-based approach is a sourcing of sales to the state where the service is delivered to the customer or the intangible property is used, in simplest terms.
And that's the method we use for sale of tangible property, isn't it?
Yes. The sales of tangible property is the market-based source currently and has been since the 50s. The intent of the 1957 version of UDIPA was to provide uniformity among the states. However, since the states have been moving away from that, the uniformity of what we call the equally weighted three-factor apportionment formula, which is sales, property, and payroll, they've been moving towards a more heavily weighted sales factor. The 2014 version of UDIPA reflects that change by double weighting the sales factor in the same way Oregon did between 1991 and 2003. So we've been shifting to a single sales factor for quite some time. The concept of a heavily weighted sales factor is popular with the states as it typically benefits in-state companies that have large investments in property and payroll. The practical effect of putting increased emphasis on the sales factor is to promote in-state growth and shift the tax burden to out-of-state companies. The following chart on the next slide will detail how we've shifted over time. But globalization and advances in computer services and technology now allows many services to be provided remotely where they weren't able to be done that way 50 years ago. Yet the test for determining the sales of intangibles remains as it was since the 50s. Today, the cost of performance method is creating an opportunity for income generated within Oregon to be sourced to another state and not included in the Oregon sales factor. So prior to 1991, Oregon used the equal weighted apportionment formula, which is one-third, 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 each of the three factors. And we started transitioning in 1991 to the double weighted, which is 50% weight on the sales factor, 25% payroll, 25% property, to what some people refer to as the super sales factor for a couple years from 2003 to 2005 to where we are today, which is we rely completely on the single sales factor or 100% sales, I think you'll hear people say. There's a couple exceptions to using the single sales factor. The utilities and telecommunication companies can still elect to use the double-weighted sales factor, and they do if it results in lower tax to them. They can choose whichever one results in the lower tax.
Do they get to switch back and forth?
They do, year to year. They get to switch back and forth. So it really begs the question, putting that weight on us is what is an Oregon sale. It makes a lot more, it's much more important now than it was before. Oregon's shift in 2005 really to single sales factor, I moved to the slide too fast, has magnified the problems with the cost of performance method of apportioning income since the apportionment formula no longer contains a property or payroll factor to offset the all or nothing impact of the cost of performance. On the other hand, cost of performance method undermines the goal of shifting to a single sales factor for taxpayers who incur their cost of performance in Oregon. This is because the cost of performance method sources income to where the production of the services is rather than where the market is. So basically goods, they're pretty easy to determine, right? The sales of goods, it's where the market is. It's sourced to where the tangible item is sold. There are some special rules around throwback sales where the taxpayer is not taxable in the state where the product is sold. It comes back into Oregon. It's not a very common. It happens. It's not particularly common. But for services, the issue of determining an Oregon sale for services or other intangibles ties to where the income-producing activity occurs. So you sometimes think of headquarters where the facilities are. That's where it happens. So for goods, the tangible product is an Oregon sale if it's delivered to a customer in Oregon or if it's shipped from Oregon to a customer outside of Oregon and the company is not subject to tax where the customer is located. And it does reflect the market. So it's generally much easier to source that. Sourcing of services is not quite that simple. The sourcing of services no longer aligns with Oregon's apportionment factors since we've moved to the single sales factor, which more closely aligns with where the taxpayer's market is or customer base is located. The cost of the corporation to the corporation of where the income producing activity occurs or cost of performance reflects apportionment factors that Oregon no longer considers, the payroll and property factors. The cost of performance test is an all or nothing approach, and again, I want to reiterate, it does not mean that there's a majority. It just means the greater proportion. You can have all the states have 3% and one state have 4%, and all of it will go to the 4% state. It doesn't have to be a majority. This all or nothing nature increases the potential for a corporation to be taxed on more than 100% of its income. For example, if you have a state I probably shouldn't give examples, but it does allow for the differing states to end up with a taxpayer having a tax on more than 100% of their income between the different states.
Mr. Chair.
It could also be the other way around.
It could also be the other way around where nothing is taxed, yes.
Could we get that example? I mean, this is all public record.
So
I mean, the state's tax rates are public, so this should be public.
Assume an income, I'll just read you the example I have here. An income-producing activity that takes place in three states, and the costs associated with the activity are as follows. So state A has 40%, state B has 35%, and state C has 25%. Mm-hmm. Based on the all or nothing nature, all of the service, all of it would be sourced to state A 100%, and nothing would come to state B or nothing would come to state C. So that reflects all or nothing. And that state A could be Oregon, state A could be Idaho. It just matters on where the cost of performance is, not where the market is.
My question was how we get over 100%.
Yeah. Oh, and do you want to answer that?
Because
one,
of the different methods, isn't it?
It's the different costs, the market-based sourcing. Like in California, for example, and I do go over this in a little bit, they have switched since 2011, I believe, to market-based sourcing. And so the U.S. Supreme Court has held that the constitutionality of the apportionment formula is equal as long as the state consistently applies it, the state. But each state gets to apply their own. So when Oregon uses a cost of performance method and they say, well, all of it comes here to Oregon, but then California says, well, all my audience or all my market is here in California, then they both have to pay tax on all of that source of income. And each state, they can litigate all the way up to the Supreme Court in each state, and that'll be held to be constitutional, and there's no relief because apportionment applies to both. Mm. Does that make sense?
I think it does.
Okay.
Yeah, if you're using different methods
in
different states, you could either end up with an all or nothing.
Right.
If you switch those two, mm-hmm. the tax would be zero.
Right, it'd be opposite. It'd be exactly the opposite.
And so if a business is headquartered in another state, but because of the natural resources in this state, the product is made in this state, then even though the headquarters and the distribution of it are out of another state, would we tax them 100% on their business? And I'm actually thinking about a company that's multinational, mm-hmm. so they are in Canada and the United States, but they're centered outside of Oregon, but in my district, they are making a product.
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, it appears, excuse me, for the record, I'm Don Jones. It appears the example you're asking is a tangible personal product to which cost of performance does not apply, and so the market approach would work where the taxpayer sold to product outside the state, it would be sourced, those sales would be sourced to another state. Under our statute.
Even though they're made here.
Even though they're made here, yes.
Yeah, they're using the word sourced in a very special way, and they mean it differently than what we normally mean. What they mean by it, I think, and you tell me if I've missed this, when they say sourced, sale sourced, what they mean is the place where the product was sold.
Okay.
Have I got
right,
that?
When we're talking, Mr. Chair, when we're talking about goods, that's exactly right. When we're talking about services, you see their services can be provided remotely now. Think architectural services. I think I have an example later where we have architectural services provided, you know, all the drafting and everything is done here in Oregon, but the bridge or whatever it is built in California. Those are the kinds of things we're talking about when we're dealing with cost of performance.
And that company would pay taxes twice.
Potentially.
Because mm-hmm. they owe it in Oregon because of our rule, and in California because they base it on the sales in the state.
That is correct. Could go the other way if they were located in California doing the service and the market was here in Oregon, it would be exactly the opposite outcome. So that's a great segue into my next slide, which is that the using the cost of performance method when so many other states are shifting to that market-based sourcing does create an unequal treatment for determining tax due to Oregon for different taxpayers. So it does increase the tax compliance efforts for both us and the taxpayer. The direct cost must be identified and computed for each separate transaction from the point of origination through the completion. It's costly and complex for both taxpayers and the department to compile and examine records related to determining direct and indirect costs. And this concept of income-producing activity activity is critical when applying the cost performance method, yet it's often difficult to identify what the activity is and where it's performed. A lot of this stuff is done in the cloud now, so where is that exactly? The single sales factor magnifies this impact because of the shift to market source. The sales factor represents the market. It's where things are sold. So this slide nine here is an example where the greater cost of performance, as you can see, the percentages between the four Western states are not substantially different. 27% is here in Oregon, 25% in California, and then 24% in Washington and Idaho. But because Oregon has the highest cost of percentage, 100% of those sales get sourced to Oregon using the cost of performance method. Now, in this example, California would be looking to the market. So the taxpayer in this situation may have some issues with perceived double taxation. MTC has adopted uniform language for the states to draw upon when considering a move to the...
MTC?
The MTC, the Multi-State Tax Commission.
Thank you.
Apologize. Thank you for that. It's an entity that works with all the states that we are part of. We're a compact state member. And so we do look to their rules for uniformity guidelines. Typically, we usually bring these concepts to your attention. And they have just recently adopted... uniformity rules related to market-based sourcing, as it, I believe in 2014, or was that 2015? 2015. So they just did that this July. Example two, here's my architectural firm example, where the greater cost of performance is in California. So the facts would be architectural blueprints are created here in Salem and used, or excuse me, they're used in Salem, but they're drawn in Sacramento. So no sales of architectural drafting services are sourced to Oregon because the services were performed in California. And then Oregon receives zero sales because the greater cost of performance is now in California, but California wouldn't either because the market was here in Oregon. So it provides inconsistency when we start dealing with the different types of states. Slide 11, it's basically, this is the inequitable portion of this, is when you've got two Oregon-based corporations. They're similar sales levels nationally and in Oregon. Both of them have 5% of their customers are in Oregon. Both of these entities have employees, 10,000 employees in Oregon. But Corporation ABC sells goods. They make something. They sell goods. Corporation XYZ sells services nationwide. So this is the outcome of that cost of performance. If the cost of performance, because they have all of that physical property and employees located here in Oregon, their greater cost of performance, 100% of their sales comes to Oregon, even though their peer firm selling goods only has to pay $4,000 in minimum tax, and the company who's got a large presence here in Oregon has to pay $100,000. That's an illustration of the inequity between the two.
And XYZ might also pay taxes in other states based on the fact that they've got using the new method.
That is correct, Mr. Chair. I believe there's 18 other. I read an article in Deloitte Tax. There's 18 other states that have shifted to some form of market-based approach already.
Oh, it's not just California.
No, it's not just California. Okay. There's actually, I have a slide that shows that later too. So, although the cost of performance method has been standard in most states for several years, there has been a trend to move away from that. 18 states with a corporate excise or income tax currently use market-based sourcing, and Arizona has passed legislation that will phase that in between 2014 and 17. So at the time that the 1957 version of UDFPA was drafted, the use of single sales factor wasn't even, factor with cost of performance wasn't even considered. It wasn't even contemplated, nor did the drafters contemplate the increasing trend towards sales of services over the sales of intangible goods. The effect of these changes was not fully recognized, even when Oregon 10 years ago, or a little over 10 years ago, enacted the single sales factor apportionment. And certainly the methods by which taxpayers and their accounting firms are interpreting the gray areas surrounding cost of performance were not anticipated. Taxpayers are increasingly interpreting the cost of performance statute in ways that may not fairly represent the business activity in Oregon from a market perspective, and the uncertainties and complexities in the law make it difficult for us to challenge those positions. The MTC did adopt, I think I already said this, that they did adopt model rules for UDIPA relating to this. And then we are currently seeing, just so you know, an increased volume of original and amended returns being filed that increasingly source sales to states other than Oregon based on cost of performance. So this slide here just summarizes the impact of the cost of performance, a method of apportionment on a non-Oregon corporation with substantial sales in Oregon, and shows that they may only pay $150 minimum tax, whereas the next slide shows an Oregon-based corporation with national sales may end up having to pay tax to Oregon, substantial amounts of tax, calculated tax or the higher minimum tax. And like I said, there's 18 other states that have shifted to this: Alabama, California, Georgia, Illinois, Iowa, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, Michigan, Minnesota, Nebraska, New York, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Utah, Wisconsin, and the District of Columbia in the last several years. And that was as recent as February of 2015, my data. Both the 1957 and the 2014 versions of UDIPA exclude certain service businesses such as financial institutions and public utilities. In 1989, the MTC adopted model rules for interstate broadcasters, which Oregon also adopted based on where their audience is located. The 2014 legislature temporarily changed the provisions for interstate broadcasters to try another method of apportionment, and LRO is to report back on the outcomes of that method of apportionment to that change in 2017 session. For financial institutions and public utilities, the Department of Revenue has authority to adopt administrative rule apportionment methods for those types of businesses because they are so unique. The administrative rules that contain the apportionment provisions for those industries currently point to the statute that requires the use of the 1957 version of cost of performance, but we're considering adopting a rule that shifts that more towards market base. And as of July of 2015, the MTC adopted model regulations for financial institutions that allows the state to remove the cost of performance sourcing method and implement a more market-based approach.
So just to so I can reify this a little bit, a big national bank with some activity in Oregon, if it's considered that their work is a service, and you're using the old method for taxing them, their taxes in Oregon would, at least for income purposes, would be pretty low. Wouldn't they? Because the majority, or at least more of their work, is done in wherever their headquarters area is.
Chair Barnhart. Again, this is Don Jones for the record, and that could be true. It depends on the circumstances of what the bank is doing. There are certain types of things under the current financial regulations that we've adopted that are already under a market-based approach, but there are some activities and transactions that under the current regulations would receive the cost of performance treatment, and so the impact isn't as significant perhaps as you were thinking.
Okay.
but there is an impact.
So you use a blended model now, where some things are under one model and some other things are under the other model.
Sure. There are some transactions that are not covered under the regulations, and because of that, they default to UDITBA with the way our rules are written, and therefore cost of performance applies.
Thank you. That's a discussion for another day when we have more time. Thanks a lot.
Mm-hmm. Just to point out, Measure 67 created the minimum tax back in, I think it was 2009. It seems like a long time ago now. But the minimum tax is a fixed dollar amount that ranges from $150 for C corporations less than $500,000 in Oregon sales to $100,000 for C corporations with Oregon sales of $100 million or more. For minimum tax purposes, the definition of Oregon sales is linked to the UDIPA provisions in the statute for determining sales of tangible property and services. For corporations subject to the minimum tax, Oregon sales will include all the income the corporation receives from the sale of tangible products to the customer located in Oregon. However, that is not always the case for income received from services. Oregon sales will include income received from services only if the income producing activity is performed in Oregon or if the income producing activity is performed both in and out of Oregon, with a greater proportion of it being performed in Oregon. So this also affects the minimum tax as well. The all or nothing approach again creates inequities for companies who sell tangible personal property compared to service sector companies. And it should be noted with Initiative Petition 28 that's now circulating for signatures for the November 2016 ballot my understanding is that initiative, IP 28, would amend the current Oregon corporate minimum tax by providing that the Oregon minimum tax for sales greater than $25 million would be $30,001 plus 2.5% over that, sales exceeding $25 million. So these proposed changes to the Oregon minimum tax would magnify the above described distortions to the Oregon minimum tax, the current distortions caused by the cost of performance standards. So you'll see this even more if that comes to pass. So in closing, the issues related to continuing the use of cost of performance method of apportioning income causes unequal treatment between goods and service providers. It creates a fairness issue between Oregon-based companies and non-Oregon-based companies, and it's inconsistent with the legislature's move to heavily weighting the sales factor to reflect the market. With that, if you have any other questions, Don and I can hopefully answer them for you.
Great. Questions? Please, Representative Dowd.
It's more, the presentation was excellent. I actually understand it, I think. So thank you. Are we going to look at any legislation that might address some of these concerns or talk further about this at some point?
I think that that's a distinct possibility, yes. I will tell you that this is an issue of first impression for me, and that's because I'm still learning how our extremely complicated tax system works. But I agree, it was a great presentation to help us to understand this wrinkle in our tax system. And as more and more actual economic activity occurs in the service realm rather than in the production and sale of goods, this area becomes more and more important, doesn't it? Other comments? Questions? Thank you. That was an extremely useful and clear presentation, but efficient as well. I appreciate it.
You should see what it does to our collections.
Do we have the next group here? That's University Venture Capital Development Fund Tax Credit Extension. We told them 10:40.
We'll find them.
I was pet. Oh, they're here? Oh, good. Please come forward. And
Beck, Representative Olson and Representative Rayfield.
Olson and Rayfield are not here yet, huh?
Yeah,
they're. Why don't we see if they're in the hall? We usually let the members go first, but if they're not here and you are, we'll let you go first instead. How's that?
You can only do what you can get input for.
Right.
So it's balls in their court.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Until we get some direction.
So if you'll state your name for the record and then present your testimony, that would be extremely helpful for us.
Sure.
We appreciate your coming today.
Sure. So I'm Brian Wall, Assistant Vice President for Research, Commercialization, Industry Partnerships at Oregon State University, and joined here with Rich Carter, CEO of ValScore. We're here today to talk about the University Venture Development Fund. We've talked about this with several of you in the past, and appreciate your time again in allowing us to kind of walk through some of this. The tax credit as a whole is a bit more complex than other tax credits because it provides the ability to repay the tax credit structure. And so we created a presentation that will walk through how the funds actually work and how they get back into the state treasury, and then also the success we've had to date, and then where we intend to go in the future.
Thank you. I think this piece of your presentation was missing from the one we got in the 2015 session.
It was.
So I think it's extremely useful for us to see this piece of it.
Great.
Thank you.
So I've broken this out into sections that I'll walk through in a minute. This is an overview slide. And what I'll walk through is how the donations come into the University Venture Development Fund, how universities help fund research and create companies, how those companies generate jobs, and then how those jobs, obviously with the tax, the tax credits and the taxes that are paid by the employees, come back into the state. So we'll just start pretty simplistically. And by the way, I should state that I'm representing all of the universities that are part of this, and that was on slide one. So all universities combined have generated $7.7 million in donations since 2007. 60% of that is the tax credit provided by the state. So there's a $4.7 million loss to the Treasury due to that, those amounts of donations here. Out of that, 27 companies launch, and just for pause here for a second and just state that what we're doing is internal to the university, we're using these funds guided by external advisory councils. So these are investors and entrepreneurs who are providing us guidance on where to direct these funds for the maximum impact. We're targeting research that has commercial potential, specifically startup companies in the state of Oregon, creating intellectual property and then licensing that intellectual property to those companies. Those license agreements from the universities include terms that provide universities equity and other payments from these companies when they're successful in commercializing. Approximately 270 jobs have been created from these companies. And to reiterate, this fund fills a gap that's commonly referred to in our area as the Valley of Death, where good ideas go to die. That's kind of the theme that this fills here. These companies would not exist. There are not venture capitalists or angel investors who invest in this type of stuff. So very early stage, very high risk, and we're targeting the research to try to get the investors to invest later. So these jobs, high-wage jobs, they're science and technology-based across the board, approximately $4.3 million return to the state treasury from the jobs created. Those companies have returned $2.9 million in licensing revenues to the universities combined. And typically the life cycle for this, because it's very early stage, very embryonic, and science and technology-based, it's in an 8 to 12-year cycle. And so we're talking long term, and we're just starting to see the financial return and the job growth that we anticipate coming well into the future. The original intent of this University Venture Development Fund and the repayment provisions was to create an evergreen fund. So the state allocated the ability to raise $8.4 million in tax credits. And the idea would be universities, upon success of the companies, would pay 20% of those successes back to regenerate tax credits into the state. So the maximum amount the state would be out continuously would be $8.4 million. The universities would continue to operate this for years to come, generating more and more companies as we do. So the net effect of what we're asking for is a renewal of this tax credit. It ended last year. Again, we raised approximately half of what was allocated in 2007. We're asking for the ability to extend the time frame, give us the length of time that's required typically for science and technology investments of this nature to raise the $8.4 million originally intended and allocated. This would allow us the ability to raise $14 million in funds from donors and continue to create jobs and opportunities. We looked at approximately where we're at today, and the bottom line shows that without renewal, we'll still, you know, we're still going to create jobs. There's still going to be a return back to the Oregon economy. But if renewed, it's going to dramatically increase the number of companies, the number of jobs, and the tax-based revenue that comes back. The effect of the 2016 bill is summarized on this slide. Again, we're asking you to allow what was contemplated and authorized in 2007, retain the $8.4 million in tax credits, allow the universities the necessary time to significantly increase the number of startups, companies, jobs in the state, and leverage, frankly, hundreds of millions of dollars in federal funding, which is what this fund taps in on the tail end to target it towards markets across the universities. And I'll pause here and turn it over to Rich Carter, who's CEO of VallisCorp, and he's got a story to share about his engagement with this fund. Okay.
And I see that Representative Olson's here. Representative, do you want to come to the podium here too?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Go ahead.
So, hello, everybody. My name is Rich Carter. I'm co-founder and CEO of a company called VallisCorp. I'm also a professor of chemistry at Oregon State University and actually chair of the department. And so I was fortunate enough to be one of the recipients in the first funding cycle of the venture fund that we're discussing today. And it actually helped me to commercialize. I brought a little sample, this compound here called WACAP, which we commercialized and licensed to a company called Sigma Aldrich. And that's actually what started a bug in me personally as a faculty member to think more entrepreneur, and ultimately led to me founding a company which in part used the technology from this called VallisCorp. This is a company that didn't exist 3 years ago. We founded in July of 2012. And actually, I was talking to Brian on the way up that I was thinking back even a year ago now, we had just two leased employees. We now are the largest Western supplier, meaning Europe and North America, of a building block called bromofluoromethane that goes into the third largest marketed drug in the world known as particulozone propionate, which means nothing to you, but if you have allergies, you probably take Flonase and Advair.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
This is actually the last chemical that goes into making Flonase and Advair.
Nice.
And we are now, again, as I said, the West's largest supplier of this. And this was something that was all really catalyzed by this one fund. We now have eight people working for us. I had two leased employees last year. There's now eight people working for us. These are all high-paying technical jobs hired with people with PhDs and BSs in chemistry, and really taking full advantage of what the venture fund is intended to do. We continue to grow and are constantly looking for lab spaces, another issue that I often come to talk about. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great.
You done?
I'm done.
Oh, man.
Gentlemen, you were not late. We started early.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name's Andy Olson. I'm state representative out of... You know what?
Are they in one chair?
Don't anybody take any photos here. Okay.
Okay.
No.
Now that you say that, my friend.
How would you like the caption to read?
Yeah.
Perfect.
It's not going to go
well. And of course, we're on the internet. We're on the internet, so our vast internet audience has already seen this.
I appreciate that. Well, at least I'm confident with two of my colleagues that are up here from the marijuana committee, so you know, I'm feeling a little bit more at home here now.
Right.
Okay.
But today we're talking about this other topic.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
So anyways, Mr. Chair, thank you so much for, you know, giving us this opportunity to share here during this time period. I just wanted to, you know, kind of share that this is a great opportunity, if we've ever had one here, for combining the opportunity of higher education with that of business. And to be able to melt those dollars and that effort together to really have some good products. And I think, you know, Brian was able to, because I've listened to him a number of times and we've had coffee together several different times, to listen to this Representative Dan Rayfield has been great to work with on this whole issue as well. So, I mean, since we're neighbors, and but then also with Rich, for you, Sharon, too, is yours. So thank you so much for that. All I can tell you is that this is a perfect opportunity for you to jump in and help us move forward with this bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, this is Dan Rayfield, State Representative, House District 16. My colleague, I apologize for him, didn't introduce himself, I don't believe.
No, I did.
You did?
I did.
All right,
absolutely.
I didn't hear it. So essentially what I wanted to do is kind of lay out, I mean, kind of my perspective on things for everyone, which has probably already been laid out. But the way that I see this is the problem that you have without this tax credit, okay, is you have innovation that's being done in the state of Oregon that isn't getting the funding it needs to get to the venture capital stage. Okay, and so this tax credit really allows us to get the most out of the innovation that's being done here in Oregon. And so what? What does it do? As you've kind of already heard, it creates jobs, it creates good paying jobs, the type of jobs that we want to have in Oregon. More importantly, it creates organic jobs within this state. So it's really easy to lure, well, maybe not easy, but you can lure jobs to the state, you know, whether you're looking at other incentives or disincentives in this, it's a state. However, when you lure jobs to the state, they are not necessarily committed to this state. Those jobs can leave and go away for various other factors. When you have people that take the innovation that's being done here, right here in Oregon, and it's created within this state, those jobs are more likely to stay here. And those are the jobs, again, the ones the type that we want. The interesting thing about this above and beyond it is that there are many examples from entities that have gone on to get the venture capital that have lured investment into the state. And there's examples at OSU where over $1 billion of investment have come into the state outside of what we're doing. And as you heard, this is a tax credit that actually returns money back to the state. And so as I look at this, this is a tax credit that basically strengthens our university's ability to act as an economic driver in this state with money that otherwise would not have come in for this purpose. And that's one of the reasons that, you know, I'm very in favor of this. It's important to my district, but I also think more importantly, it's important to, you know, the state of Oregon. So it's a good use of our tax dollars, which come back to the state.
Okay. I'm not sure who was first. Let's go with Representative Whitsitt.
Yes,
and then I have a bunch of others.
Thank you for bringing this forward. Would this apply to all the universities in Oregon, all of the public state universities? Or would it apply to, say, Reed College or private universities?
It applies also to public universities and OHSU.
Great. Representative Helm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you give us your perspective, whoever thinks they understand this the best, on the difficulties Oregon has in attracting venture capital?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Helm. There's a handful of difficulties. One is venture capital typically resides outside of the state, right? We have a handful of VCs that kind of play in the Portland region. We have a lot of angel investors, which is great, and that's growing, individual investors. The companies that have come out of OSU that I'm aware of have been able to attract venture capital, but again, it's come from out of state. And so the more companies and the more successes that we're able to show just statewide, regardless if universities are involved or not, the more interested that venture capitalists will actually merge and start showing up in the state of Oregon. I've been down to the Silicon Valley. I've talked with several venture capitalists, several alum. They've all had consistent statements that there's good startups that are coming out of Oregon, but right now there's not enough throughput for them to build an office here, for example.
Thank you.
Just quick follow-up.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Helm, the other thing to keep in mind is that this is bridge funding for a lot of folks to get to the venture capital, right? So you're looking at this from, you know, the proof of concept phase. So this is oftentimes much earlier than you get to the actual venture capital.
Quick follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
Thanks for confirming my suspicion. This is really important. This is a really important part of your bill is the organic homegrown part, because when those small kernels of ideas start to turn into a concept for a company and can start to be monetized, the venture funds in Silicon Valley will say, pick up shop and come down here. This is where all the action is. No one's going to take you seriously until you come down here because you don't have a big enough idea. Or anyway, they think the world revolves around them down there. And we need these hooks to keep Oregon businesses here. So we're going to have to carve this out ourselves because they're not going to help us do it. And there's a tremendous gravitational pull out of state right now with venture funding.
Thank you. Representative Nellis.
I think I'm unclear about how much are we out. So could someone explain again? I'm trying to look at the follow the money charts and figure it out. So, and I'm looking at the graph where it shows what we generate in income over time. But maybe someone could line out the numbers for me. So, like, we short ourselves in revenue $8 million a year. Okay. How do we recoup that again? In the long term, that's what I'm trying to figure out.
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Nose. First, the total package is $8.4 million, so it's not per year. That was allocated in 2007. It went through 2015. We're asking for an extension of the 8.4 through 2022. So that's one note. And if you're looking at, I think, this next slide in terms of that might be the income tax. The idea would be the universities would have the full ability and length of time needed to raise $14 million, which would complete the total allocation from the state of $8.4 million. Any successes that the university has, which we've had already and repaid $582,000, we would use that to regenerate tax credit authority. So the state would only be out a maximum of $8.4 million at any given time period. And the idea would be through the continued growth of companies and successes, we would continue to reauthorize tax credit authority to generate donations and fund more development in this area.
Okay. I think, you know what, I'll get somebody offline.
Now I'm confused.
But
my impression was we're setting up a revolving fund. Is that true or not?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
The $14 million fund.
Yes. It's okay. $8.4 million tax credit revolving fund.
So now, okay. So when you get money in and you've received, you had a number in this list, you received $2.9 million so far, according to your report, and of that, $582,000 have been paid back to regenerate tax credits, paid back to the state treasurer.
Correct.
So, what that does then is in effect pay down on the amount of the tax loss, which, if I understand this regeneration term, means that now you get to go out and ask for an additional donation. Which would generate a tax credit up to an additional $582,000.
Correct.
Have I got that right?
Yep.
So the fund ends up getting bigger than $14 million over time, the total fund, including the amount that's out.
The total amount raised could be significantly more than $14 million, but the tax credits authorized by the state would never grow higher than 8.4 because we would be repaying.
Right.
And therefore regenerating.
And so a portion of the money you get back goes to that. A portion of the money, the $2.9 million, goes the other $2.4 million, where does that go?
That resides in the universities and incentivizes the faculty and students and staff and the administration and the intellectual property costs and funds all the potential losses that aren't successes.
All right. So some of it goes back directly into departments that are generating these ideas.
Correct.
For example. All right. Yes, Representative Leininger.
Thank you. Well, thank you all for being here today. I think this is a really good idea. And I am trying to look skeptically at at all tax credits, and I think that this is a really good one because it's building on the assets that we have in our state. It's working with people who are already invested in Oregon, and you're right that we need some risk tolerant capital at the early stage of businesses, because not every one of them is going to succeed. And that's, you know, that's 100% to be built into the process of winnowing out the ones that are going to be successful. So I think because we don't happen to have the same number of really early stage venture capital providers that some states have, it really is a good idea for us to step in and at this modest price point try to seed new companies. You had 27 started so far. Not everyone's going to be a home run, and that's supposed to happen, but your example was very compelling. I appreciate you bringing it forward.
Thank you. Yeah, Representative Johnson.
One question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you give us an idea just what type of gross revenue some of these startups are generating? Just to, so we can kind of quantify what kind of...
That would help me.
What's your business bottom line look like? Just what's the size of the company?
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson. In specifically for those who have received University Venture Development Fund, it's all over the map right now. You know, I mentioned it's an 8 to 12 year kind of cycle, and generally, you know, when we were authorized in 2007, it took a few years to start fundraising, to allocate the funds, to generate the licensing and all that. So the 2.9 million license revenues really have come, it's kind of like an 80-20 rule still, you know, that 80% probably has come from a couple companies at this point. And those companies are generating in the range of, you know, several million dollars, but not hundreds of millions at this point. The intent would be, and certainly from a university perspective, the intent is incredible impact to society, frankly. And when we have some a company like NuScale, who was founded prior to us having this ability, but certainly would have benefited significantly and shortened their time had we had this available. Sure. Mm-hmm. You know, they have somewhere in the neighborhood of 500 to 600 employees at this point, and they've received, you know, $262 million in federal funds plus another $500 million in investment into the state. We're talking about, you know, serious potential. So we're not going to have a significant number of new scales, but, you know, 1 in 10, 1 in 20, as we continue to do this, is what we're looking at, is generate a couple of heavy hitters and generate a significant number of medium players and high growth companies that reside in the state. The capital and the CEO, where they're located, are the two biggest keys to keeping companies in the state, along with other kind of regional incentives to kind of retain them here. So to the extent that we can utilize the fund to start them and launch them and then continue to work and partner with them as a university, we've got a pretty good track to keep them.
Please.
So one additional point I want to make is Oregon has a wonderful ecosystem that goes beyond this. And so this really is the seed that starts all these things. And so, for example, we got Venture Development Fund money, and we went on to get Onami Gap money, which allowed us to ultimately commercialize our product. And I think this is really that key initial seed that grows on to support the rest of the ecosystem. And we have a great ecosystem that helps to keep these businesses here. And it's really important that we provide these early seeds to get to that next stage that leads to the venture capital funding.
So you went from a breakthrough, a scientific breakthrough, to early development, and then to the point where you could actually sell something.
Correct.
Okay.
Just the other point to make, I guess, is that millions or tens of millions in gross income for these startups is not necessarily an indication of profitability yet.
Correct.
Thank you.
I can comment, in our first year of production, we were profitable and we grew over 300% last year.
Great. Thank you. Does the university maintain any kind of equity interest in these businesses?
Mr. Chair, it's subject to negotiation, but with most startups, the university accepts equity in lieu of any payments and takes additional risk on carrying intellectual property costs and other burdens to allow the company time to grow and obtain investment in them.
And in other cases, you accept a royalty or?
Accept a royalty or an upfront payment or milestone payments or annual payments.
Okay. I mean, I know that we adopted a constitutional amendment some time ago for the purpose of allowing universities to maintain an equity interest, which the Constitution otherwise forbids, precisely so that the university could benefit from the discoveries that are made on university time and benefit from the breakthrough company that really does end up with large sales. And, of course, the case that I remember was the one involving an important drug that was developed at OHSU that the university was accepted a royalty for, but was unable to take an equity interest and therefore did not benefit very, very much from the huge breakout success. So that's the reason I asked that question.
Yeah, Mr. Yeah. Chair, I don't think we'd be in the position we're in if we didn't have the ability to accept equity in companies. That was a huge move by the state years ago. Right. We've accepted equity in, you know, dozens of startups at this point in time, and it's not just a benefit to the university; it's a benefit to the companies who don't have any money at the beginning, and allows them the time and the ability to actually attract capital as needed.
Well, and of course, from the legislature's point of view, we're significantly underfunding the universities now. Looking at the historic numbers, you shudder to think how much we'd need to increase it to get back to where we were in 1990, for example. This is a way of allowing allowing you to go out and raise some of your own money, in addition to getting donations and exorbitant tuition costs, which you're stuck with.
Mr. Chair, I know that you were over time, but yep. DJ Voigt from Oregon Business Association is here, too, and just wanted to kind of just chime in a tiny bit.
Ah, okay. I didn't realize we had another person. I would have not talked so much. While he's coming up, I want to thank you all very much for coming today and for the two members for presenting this bill this concept, which I take it will be a bill later.
Thank you.
And, of course, we are on borrowed time, so make your comments quickly.
Yes, sir. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, nice to see you again. Good morning. For the record, DJ Voigt, Vice President of Government Affairs, Oregon Business Association. And we just wanted to show up today and let you know that the UVDF is something we very much support, view it as a very cost-effective mechanism for the state to harness local companies' innovation, get them over that initial hurdle. Representative Helm made a great point. There's not a whole lot of venture capital in Oregon. There just isn't. There's no critical mass here like there is in the Bay Area or Seattle. So this is one of those tools that can keep local homegrown companies, get them over the hump. So we just support this and wanted to let you know.
Thank you so much. Questions? Thank you. We very much appreciate your being here today. And Representative Olson, thank you for bringing the issue to me. I appreciate it. Nothing else for the good of the order. We will see you all on bright and early at 1 o'clock on February 1st. After, of course, we'll be meeting, the House will be meeting before that. And with that, the committee is adjourned.
I just understand why.
With that, the committee is adjourned.